10. Earl Greyharbor's townhouse, Tellisburg.
"You can't be serious, Pinsman," the Earl of Greyharbor protested.
"I know you don't want to hear this, Regis," Wave Thunder said, "but I can't justify not taking it seriously."
"And have you told His Majesty about it?" Greyharbor demanded.
"Not yet," Wave Thunder conceded. "His Majesty and Caleb are even closer to the Duke than you are. Until, and unless I'm certain there's a fire somewhere under all this smoke, I'm not going to tell them anything which could hurt them this badly on a personal level. Surely you don't think I enjoy telling you that someone I know is this close to you and your daughter, the father of your grandchildren, could be a traitor?"
Greyharbor looked across at him with narrow eyes. The two of them sat in facing armchairs in a private sitting room in Greyharbor Hall, the Earl's Tellisburg mansion. Each of them held a half-filled glass, and a bottle of excellent Sidermark whiskey sat on a table at the Earl's elbow. It was late afternoon, and heavy weather was rolling in from the southwest, sweeping through the passes of the Stiven Mountains and in from the Cauldron, that shallow, current-racked stretch of seawater between Caris and Taro Island. The rising wind drove heavier waves against the harbor's breakwaters, and all along the waterfront crews were battening down in preparation for heavy weather. Overhead, the morning sunlight had turned into the heavy dimness of cloudy early evening, and thunder muttered ominously. The clouds which had obscured the sun were black-bottomed and thick, and lightning flickered here and there among them. The weather, Wave Thunder thought, was an unfortunately apt mirror of the tension inside this sitting room.
"No, of course I don't think you enjoy telling me," Greyharbor said finally, "which doesn't mean I think you're right, however."
"Believe me," Wave Thunder said with the utmost sincerity, "in this case I would far, far rather discover my suspicions are misplaced. And I have no intention of damaging the king's relationship with his cousin, until and unless I'm certain there's a reason to."
"But you're not quite that concerned about my relationship with Calvin?"
Greyharbor said, with a wintry smile.
"You know better than that, Regis."
This time there was a bit of a bite in Wave Thunder's voice, and he met the Earl's eyes very levelly.
"I wouldn't have told you anything until I knew one way or the other either if the law didn't require me to."
Greyharbor gazed at him again for a second or two, and then, unhappily, nodded. The law was very clear, and had been since Harald's great-grandfather's day. In Caris, unlike most other lands, not even the most commonly born man could be simply seized and hauled off to prison. Not legally, at any rate, although Greyharbor knew as well as any that the law had been bent, and even outright violated upon occasion. Legally, however, any citizen of Caris must be charged with some specific offense before a king's magistrate, before he could be imprisoned, even on suspicion, by the secular authorities. And he must be convicted of that offense before the king's bench, before he could be kept there. The church's courts were another matter entirely, of course, and there was a certain tension between crown and church as a result, but both Harald and Bishop Executor Zerald attempted to minimize it as much as possible. Nobles enjoyed considerably greater protection, however, even in Caris, which, Greyharbor would have said, if he'd ever bothered to consider the point at all, was the way it ought to be. In the case of a noble of Calvin Armagh's stature, even the crown was required to move carefully. Wave Thunder could not legally initiate the sort of investigation he obviously intended to propose without the express approval of the king, or of his first counselor. In fact, it was entirely possible, if Greyharbor wanted to be a stickler about it, that Wave Thunder had already exceeded his legal authority in this case. A part of the Earl was tempted to make that point, but he put the temptation aside. The very idea that Calvin could possibly be a traitor was beyond ridiculous. Yet, Wave Thunder was right. He did have a responsibility to examine even the most ludicrous allegations, and the fact that Calvin was Grey Harbor's son-in-law only made the situation more painful for both of them.
"I know you wouldn't have told me if you hadn't had to, Benjamin," Grey Harbor sighed after a moment. "And I know this is damned awkward. I think the entire idea is preposterous and more than a little insulting, but I know where the original accusation came from. Personally, I think this so-called Seijin has overreached himself, and I'm looking forward to seeing him try to explain to His Majesty why he's seen fit to falsely impugn the honor of a member of His Majesty's own family. But I realize you need my authorization before you can continue. So, tell me what you suspect, and how you intend to prove or disprove your suspicions. Unless, of course," he smiled thinly, "Seijin Merlin has seen fit to accuse me of treason as well."
"Of course he hasn't," Wave Thunder said gruffly, then looked down into his whiskey glass. He considered the clear, amber depths for a moment or two, then took a sip and looked back up at his host.
"Very well, Regis," he said. "Here's what we have so far. First..."
Thunder rumbled, loud and harsh, crashing across the heavens, and Regis Yowance, Earl of Grey Harbor, stood looking out an open window across the immaculate garden of his townhouse. Wind whipped branches and flowering shrubbery, flogging the dark, glossy leaves to show their lighter undersurfaces. The air seemed to prickle on his skin, and he smelled the sharp, distinctive scent of lightning.
"Not long," he thought. "Not long until the storm breaks."
He lifted his whiskey glass and drank, feeling its hot, honeyed fire burned down the back of his throat as he gazed into the darkness. Lightning flared suddenly out over the white-capped harbor, flaming through the clouds like the braided whip of Langhorne's Rakurai, etching the entire world ever so briefly in livid, blinding light, and fresh thunder exploded, louder than ever in its wake. Grey Harbor watched for a few more seconds, then turned away and looked around the comfortable, lamp-lit sitting room Wave Thunder had left a little more than 2 hours ago. The Earl walked back across to his armchair, poured more whiskey, and sat. His mind insisted upon replaying everything Wave Thunder had said, and he closed his eyes in pain.
"It can't be true," he thought. "It can't be. There has to be some other explanation, some other answer, whatever Sea Farmer and Benjamin may think."
But he was no longer as confident of that as he had been, and that lost assurance hurt. It hurt far worse than he'd believed it possibly could when he'd been so certain it could never happen. He opened his eyes once more, staring out the window, waiting for the first crashing waterfall of the gathering storm. He'd been prepared to reject any possibility of his son-in-law's guilt, not simply because Calvin was the king's cousin, next in line for the throne after Harald's own children and the designated regent for his minor children, should something happen to Harald and Caleb, not simply because of Calvin's importance to the kingdom, and not simply because of the undoubted additional power and influence which his daughter's marriage to the Duke had brought to Grey Harbor's own position, or because Calvin had always been his staunch ally on the Privy Council and in Parliament. No, he'd been prepared to reject that possibility because Calvin had always been a kind and loving husband to his daughter, Jennifer, and a doting father to her two children. Because he'd stepped into the place of Grey Harbor's long-dead son, Charles. Because the Earl of Grey Harbor loved his son-in-law. But, he admitted grimly to himself, if it had been anyone else, he would have found Wave Thunder's suspicions persuasive.
"Not conclusive," he told himself, rallying gamely.
but then his shoulders sagged again.
No, not conclusive, but suggestive enough that they have to be investigated. Suggestive enough that they have to affect the way Harald feels about him, the extent to which Harald can trust him. Damn that so-called Sejin!
He could have dismissed all of it without a qualm, but for the deaths of Sea Farmer's investigators in Hyratha, and Calvin's association in ventures with known emerald trading interests. Like many nobles, Calvin sometimes found the expense involved in maintaining the appearances expected of a man of his rank punishing, and his own taste for expensive hunting hounds, wyverns, and lizards, and for occasional high-stakes wagers, put even more demands on his purse. He was far from a poor man, yet the financial strain was undeniable. Upon occasion, and although that was scarcely common knowledge, Grey Harbor had known about it for years. But somehow, whenever funds seemed to be growing a bit tight, one or another of his trading ventures always succeeded. And just a few too many of them, the Earl knew now, involved partnerships with men whose ultimate loyalty was suspect, to say the very least.
"But there's no evidence Calvin knows he's dealing with people like that," Grey Harbor thought. "His duties are mainly military, and he's not anywhere near as deeply involved as Binsman and I in the day-to-day effort to ferret out Narman's agents. He's never been briefed as thoroughly as I have. As far as I know, he's never had any reason to question the loyalty of his partners, or wonder if some of them have been using him without his knowledge."
The Earl brooded over his whiskey glass as thunder rolled and rumbled again. The blue-white flicker of lightning flared once more, driving eye-searing fury across storm-purple heavens, and he heard the first few raindrops pelt down on the townhouse's slate roof.
Was it truly possible that Calvin, his son-in-law, the king's first cousin, was a traitor? Could he have fooled everyone that completely for so long? Or was it all still a mistake? Only a matter of circumstantial evidence which ultimately meant nothing. Nothing but appearances manipulated into something suspicious by Sajan Merlin's accusations?
The Earl drained his glass and refilled it. He knew he shouldn't. Knew he'd already drunk enough to impair his judgment. But it helped with the pain. He ran back over Wave Thunder's proposal, and his jaw tightened. The most damning evidence, if it could be called that, against Calvin were the deaths of Sea Farmer's investigators in Hyratha, the investigators whose identities only he had known. So Sea Farmer proposed to give him the identity of another of his investigators, along with the information that the man in question was hot on the heels of a highly placed emerald agent. From Sea Farmer's description of the suspected agent, it would be apparent to Calvin, assuming he was actually guilty, that the agent was one of Calvin's own business partners.
"And if he is guilty," Grey Harbor thought grimly, "Sea Farmer's new investigator will go the same way as his predecessors. Or that's what would happen without the dozen additional men Calvin won't know about."
If there was an attempt on Sea Farmer's man, or if the suspect in question abruptly disappeared, it still wouldn't prove anything. But the circumstances would be utterly damning, and a full-scale investigation would become inevitable. Grey Harbor emptied the whiskey glass yet again and refilled it. He was halfway through the second bottle, he noticed, and grimaced.
11. The Duke of Tyrion's Mansion, Kingdom of Karis.
"Your Grace, I'm sorry to disturb you, but you have a visitor."
Calvin Armagh, Duke of Tyrion, looked up from the correspondence on his desk and raised one eyebrow at his majordomo.
"A visitor, Maris? At this hour?"
The Duke waved elegantly at the window of his study and the pelting sheets of rain running down its diamond panes.
"In this weather?"
Yes, Your Grace.
Maurice Willems had been in Tyrion's service for the better part of 16 years. His expression was almost serene, but Tyrion saw something else in his eyes and straightened in his chair.
"And who might this visitor be?"
he asked.
"It's Earl Greyharbor, Your Grace."
"What?"
Despite himself, Tyrion was unable to keep the astonishment out of his voice, and Willems bowed slightly.
"The Earl himself?"
Tyrion pressed, and Willems bowed again.
"Did he—"
Tyrion cut himself off. Nothing he could think of would have brought his father-in-law out on a night like this one. Certainly not without having so much as previously hinted he might come to call. Which meant it had to be some sort of dire emergency. But the Earl obviously, and not surprisingly, hadn't confided the nature of that emergency to Willems.
"The Earl," the majordomo said after a moment, "came by carriage, Your Grace. He is accompanied only by a single personal guardsman. I showed him and his man into the library and offered him refreshment before I came to announce his presence to you. He declined the offer."
Tyrion's eyebrow went up again, this time in genuine alarm. The First Counselor of Carys had no business wandering about with only a single guard at any time, and especially not on a night like this. He started to speak quickly, then made himself stop and think for a moment first.
"Very well, Maurice," he said after a moment. "I'll go to him immediately."
He paused long enough to jot a few hastily scribbled words on a sheet of paper, then folded it and handed it to Willems.
"I can't imagine what brings the Earl out in this sort of weather, but I'm sure he didn't set out lightly. Have his coach and coachman sent to the stables. I have no idea how long the Earl will be staying. Overnight, if I can convince him not to go back out into the storm. But, at the least, let's get his horses and his coachman out of the rain for as long as they're here."
"Of course, Your Grace."
"And after you've given instructions for that, please personally deliver that note to Captain Janssen."
Frank Janssen was the commander of Tyrion's personal guard, the only one of his senior servants who'd been with him even longer than Willems.
"Of course, Your Grace," the majordomo murmured yet again, and withdrew from the study at the Duke's gesture.
Tyrion sat a moment longer, gazing unseeingly at the rain-lashed window. Then he drew a deep breath, stood, and walked out of the room.
"Father,"
Tyrion said as he stepped briskly into the library. Telesburg's temperatures virtually never dropped below freezing, but they could get a bit on the cool side, especially in the winter, and a night with weather like this was sufficiently chill for a fire to have been kindled. It was as much for emotional comfort as to drive off the physical chill, and the Earl of Greyharbor stood in front of the hearth, holding out his hands to the crackling flame. The library was much larger than Tyrion's study. In fact, if Willems hadn't already ushered the Earl into it, Tyrion would have chosen a smaller, more intimate setting. The vast room had been added to the Tyrion townhouse by the present Duke's maternal grandfather, who'd been all but illiterate, as a wedding gift for his daughter. The old man had spared no expense to give his beloved oldest child the most impressive library collection in Telesburg, and he'd insisted on providing proper housing for it as well. Many-paned skylights were set into both sides of the vast chamber's vaulted ceiling. They ran in a wide circle around the look-through fireplace's stone chimney, arranged to provide natural sunlight for the reading desks at the library's heart. Now deluging rain beat on the thick glass with endless waterfall patience while thunder rumbled and crashed overhead, and fresh lightning glared beyond the skylights like the very fury of Schuler as the Earl looked up at his son-in-law's entrance. Tyrion was shocked by Greyharbor's expression. The Earl's face was drawn, clenched around some heavy burden, and his eyes were laden with misery. The Duke crossed to him quickly, holding out both hands, and his own concern deepened as he got close enough to smell his father-in-law's breath. "Father," he said more gently, putting his hands on the shorter, more slightly built Earl's shoulders, "what is it? What brings you out on a night like this?" He jerked his head at the water-streaming skylights, and his alarm clicked up another notch as he noted the water dripping from the Earl's soaked ponytail. Had his father-in-law charged out into a raging storm like this one without so much as a hat?
"The Earl began, then stopped, staring up into his son-in-law's face, seeing the powerful family resemblance to King Harald. There was less of Caleb in Tyrion's features, but he could almost have been a slightly older mirror of the king.
"What?" Tyrion asked gently, his eyes dark with concern and affection. Surely, Greyharbor thought, that concern, that love, had to be genuine. He couldn't be mistaken about that. And yet...
"Tell me," the Duke commanded in a soft voice, simultaneously urging the Earl away from the hearth and toward a leather-upholstered armchair.
He pushed his father-in-law gently down into the chair, just as Morris Willems knocked lightly at the library door and entered, personally carrying a silver tray laden with a bottle of the Duke's finest Harchong brandy and two glasses. Tyrion hadn't ordered the brandy, but he nodded in approval as the majordomo set the tray on a small table by the Earl's chair, and then withdrew as quietly as he'd appeared. The Duke unstoppered the brandy and poured two glasses, giving the obviously distraught Greyharbor a few moments. Then he extended one glass to the Earl, took the other, and settled into the facing armchair.
"Father," he said firmly as Greyharbor accepted his brandy glass.
The Earl simply held it, not even sipping, and Tyrion continued in that same firm tone.
"You obviously didn't come out in weather like this on a whim, so tell me what brings you here. Tell me what I can do to help."
To his astonishment, his father-in-law's eyes abruptly filled with tears.
"I shouldn't have come," Greyharbor said finally, and his voice was hoarse, his words more than a little slurred.
Obviously, Tyrion realized, he'd been drinking even more heavily than the Duke had guessed.
"I shouldn't have come," the Earl repeated. "But I had to. I had to, Calvin."
"Why, Father? What's happened?"
"Calvin, you've been involved with some people you shouldn't have been," Greyharbor said.
Tyrion's eyes narrowed, and the Earl shook his head.
"I know you had no reason to suspect them," he continued, "but some of the men with whom you've been doing business are... they aren't what you think they are."
"Father," Tyrion said slowly, "I'm afraid I don't understand what you're talking about."
"I know, I know."
Greyharbor looked away, staring into the crackling fire, while George Howard, his personal guardsman, stood uncomfortably behind his chair. Howard had joined Greyharbor's service over 12 years ago. He'd become the Earl's personal guardsman 2 years later, following his predecessor's accidental drowning on a fishing trip, and he'd long since proven his loyalty. Yet it was obvious Howard had no idea what had so perturbed the Earl, although Greyharbor's longtime retainer was clearly concerned about whatever it was. Well, that was fair enough. Tyrion was concerned, too. Despite the heavy smell of whiskey on the Earl's breath, his sentences came out almost normally. The consequences, no doubt, of all of his years of political and diplomatic experience. That clarity of phrase could have fooled many people into underestimating the extent of his inebriation, but Tyrion knew him better than that. It was obvious to him that Greyharbor was unfocused, searching not simply for words, but for the thoughts he wanted to put into words. Tyrion had never seen him like this, and he reached out and laid one hand on the older man's knee.
"What do you know, Father?"
His gentle question was all but lost in the next crash of thunder, and Grey Harbor looked back from the fire to focus a bit owlishly on his face.
"Calvin," he said, "some of your business partners, some of the men you think are friends, aren't. They're spies, traitors."
He shook his head, eyes no longer filled with tears, but still dark with concern.
"You shouldn't be associated with them."
"Spies?" Tyrion sat back in his chair abruptly, his eyebrows lowering.
"Traitors?"
He shook his head.
"I don't know what you're talking about, Father." "I'm talking about men you do business with, who also work for Narmon of Emerald," Grey Harbor said. "I'm talking about the man you buy hunting wyverns from. You're dealing with people who are the enemies of the king and the kingdom, Calvin. And," he drew a deep breath, "there are some who suspect that you know you are."
"People suspect me of treason?" Tyrion demanded sharply. Behind the Earl's chair, Howard's face went abruptly and totally expressionless. Clearly, the guardsman wasn't at all happy about the turn the conversation had just taken.
"Some people, yes," Grey Harbor said.
"Who?" Tyrion asked harshly. "Who are they?"
"I can't tell you that. You know that. I shouldn't have said as much as I already have. But I'm telling you, Calvin, you have to disassociate yourself from those men."
"I don't even know which men you're talking about," Tyrion protested.
"I can tell you that much," Grey Harbor said. "Lahang, the wyvern trainer, he's one of Narmon's people. And Taral and Thorson, the merchants, they are too. And there are others."
"Which others?"
Tyrion set his own brandy glass back on the tray, and his eyes were narrow, intent, as they focused on the Earl's face.
"Those are the most important three," Grey Harbor told him, waving his left hand. "Oh, there are a few others, but those are the ones we know are important to Narmon's operations here in Karis." "Who knows?"
"Wave Thunder, of course," Grey Harbor said a bit impatiently.
"Sea Farmer, others."
"Does it really matter, Calvin?"
"Of course it matters, if they think I'm a traitor too, simply because of men I know, men I do business with."
"The point is to demonstrate that you aren't a traitor."
"The point is that I want to know who would dare to accuse me of such a crime," Tyrion said hotly. "I'm Harald's cousin, for Langhorne's sake."
"I don't blame you for being angry," Grey Harbor replied. "But no one wants to believe anything but the best about you. You must know that. It's just that—"
He broke off, shaking his head, and Tyrion glowered at him.
"Just what, Father?" he demanded.
"There's been an accusation," Grey Harbor said, after a moment, glancing back at the fire. "It's ridiculous, of course, but there it is. And given the person from whom it came, Binzanon had no choice but to consider it seriously."
"The person from whom it came," Tyrion repeated slowly, his eyes intent and thoughtful. Then he nodded to himself.
"It was the foreigner," he said. "This Merlin, the one some people are calling a Sejin, wasn't it?"
"I can't tell you that. I won't."
Grey Harbor shook his head.
"I think it's nonsense, that it may well be politically motivated, but I can't tell you its source, at least until Binzerman's disprove the charges. And,"
he looked back at Tyrion, his own eyes narrowing,
"the best way for you to help disprove them is to voluntarily disassociate yourself from Narmon's known agents and tell Binzerman and Sea Farmer everything you know about them."
"Everything I know? You make it sound as if you think I have been consorting with traitors."
"Damn it, Calvin!"
Grey Harbor said, his voice sharper than it had been. He set his own untouched glass back onto the tray forcefully enough to slop brandy over the rim, and glared at his son-in-law.
"You have been! Whether you knew you were doing it or not is immaterial as far as that's concerned. We know they're Narmin's men. What matters now is for you to demonstrate that now that you've been told who they are, you want to help us prove they are."
"Why?" Tyrion asked harshly.
"If Wave Thunder already knows they're traitors, what am I supposed to add to his knowledge about them?"
"Anything you can," Grey Harbor said slowly, his eyebrows tightening. "Anything that might help."
He sat back in his chair, gazing at the Duke narrowly.
"Surely you don't need me to tell you how it works, Calvin. I would have thought you'd be as eager as I am to do that."
"Why should I be? You aren't the one some unknown foreigner is accusing of treason."
Tyrion snorted angrily and pushed himself up out of his armchair. He stamped over to the fire and glared down into the crackling flames, his back to his father-in-law, his hands clasped behind him and his shoulders tight.
"Why should I be so eager to defend my name, my family's name, against that sort of accusation?"
"To discredit him in turn," Grey Harbor said, still speaking slowly, staring at the younger man's rigid spine.
"Shan way with him," Tyrion growled. "I'm the king's cousin, not some wretched little backcountry baron. Why should I care about the charges of some ragged adventurer?"
"You shouldn't," the Earl said, more slowly yet. "Unless they're true."
Tyrion wheeled back to face him, just that little bit too quickly, and saw it in his father-in-law's eyes. Saw that Grey Harbor hadn't been quite as drunk as Tyrion had thought he was. Saw the concern in those eyes turning into something else. Something both far sadder and much harder. As the speed of his turn, or some flicker of his own expression, abruptly confirmed what Grey Harbor had so desperately wanted not to believe.
"Langhorne," the Earl said softly. "They are true, aren't they? You already knew Lahang is Narmin's chief agent here in Telisburg."
Tyrion opened his mouth, obviously to deny the accusation, but then he paused. He stood for a moment looking at the Earl, then glanced at Howard.
"Yes,"
he said then, his voice clipped but composed. "Yes, Father, I knew Lahang was one of Narmin's spies. And I'll admit he approached me, wanted to recruit me into a plot against Harald."
"And you never told anyone?"
Grey Harbor's words were no longer slurred. They came crisp, cold. There was anger in them, and sorrow, and Tyrion shrugged.
"No, I didn't," he agreed. "Why should I? If Lahang wanted to use me in some plot against Harald, he'd have to give me some of the details, wouldn't he? How better to position myself to discover what Narmin was up to?"
"If that's what you were really thinking, you should have taken the information to Binzimund the instant Lahang approached you."
"And risk having the secret get out before I'd had the opportunity to actually learn anything?" Tyrion began. "I hardly think—"
"Spare me,"
Grey Harbor interrupted sharply. Tyrion looked at him, and the Earl shook his head.
"I've known Binzimund Race for more than 25 years. You've known him almost that long. We both know that secrets entrusted to him don't get out."
He shook his head again, slowly, sadly.
"No, Calvin. The only reason you wouldn't have told Binzimund would be that you were considering accepting Lahang's offer."
Despite the thunder grumbling overhead, despite the rain pounding on the skylights and the crackle of the fire, silence seemed to hover in the library. And then, finally, the Duke of Tyrion nodded.
I was, he conceded. And why not? My blood's the same as that in Harald's veins. My grandfather was his grandfather. If that Kraken had taken his life, and not simply his knee, the throne would have been mine. Why shouldn't I consider the possibility that it still could be?
Grey Harbor stared at him, as if seeing him for the very first time.
I thought I knew you, the Earl said at last,
so softly his voice was all but drowned by the sound of the furious winter rain.
But if you can ask me that, then I never knew you at all, did I?
Of course you did, Tyrion made a throwing-away gesture. I've been your son-in-law for 14 years. You've become my father in truth, not just in name. Anything I may have thought, may have done where Harald is concerned, doesn't change that.
It changes everything, Calvin, Grey Harbor said. Can't you even see that? I was the king's man, his servant, before I was ever your father-in-law. I swore an oath to him, the same one you swore, and I can't break it. Not for you, not for Xenophir, or the boys. Not even for me, for my love for my daughter's husband.
I see. Tyrion stood gazing at him for endless seconds, hands clasped behind him once again, then shrugged slightly.
So, I assume I can't talk you into forgetting about this, or throwing your lot in with mine.
The Duke smiled crookedly.
We'd make a formidable team, Father. Think about it. The kingdom's ranking duke and the first counselor? We could do it, if you could just forget about that oath of yours.
Never, Grey Harbor said firmly, sadly.
Which leaves what?
Benjamin's already more than half convinced Merlin's accusations were accurate, the Earl said. Sea farmers already investigating. And now I know the truth, Calvin. It's only a matter of time, and not much of that, until the king knows as well. I think you have only one chance to salvage anything from this, and that's to turn king's evidence.
Confess what I've done. Throw myself on Harald's mercy and promise to tell him everything I know?
What else can you hope for?
I can still hope to win, Father, Tyrion said softly.
Win? Grey Harbor repeated incredulously. How? It's over, Calvin. All you can do now is try to minimize the damage. You're Harald's cousin, and he and Caleb both love you. Of course they'll be angry, furious, but you're also the most important nobleman in the entire kingdom, after Caleb himself. Obviously this is going to change everything where their trust in you is concerned, but if you admit what you've done, do your best to help undo it, Harald will do all he can to keep the entire thing quiet. You know that.
Dear loving cousin Harald, Tyrion said, his voice harder, an ugly light glittering in his eyes.
Father, it should be me on the throne, not him.
Grey Harbor's expression hardened. He looked at his son-in-law, and he saw the man he'd always known, and a total stranger. A stranger so soured by ambition and resentment that he'd become both traitor and would-be usurper, yet somehow been able to conceal the depths of that bitter emotion from everyone, even from those who loved him.
Calvin, the first counselor said coldly, the throne is not yours. It never will be. Accept that now, and do what you can to make amends with Harald, while the opportunity still exists.
I don't think so, Tyrion said.
Grey Harbor stiffened in his chair, and Howard's hand dropped to the hilt of his sword, but the Duke ignored the guardsman, gazing straight into Grey Harbor's eyes.
"It seems I can't convince you to join me," he said, "but I'm afraid you can't convince me to join you either, Father. Which leaves us with a bit of a problem, doesn't it?"
"You can't win, Calvin."
"I disagree." Tyrion reached up to rest one hand on the mantelpiece of the fireplace beside him and smiled at his father-in-law. "I know you, and I know Wave Thunder," he said easily, almost lightly. "You wouldn't have blabbed about this to anyone else. Not yet." "Sea Farmer?"
"Yes,"
he nodded. "I'll give you that. And Sea Farmer may have spoken to one or two people he knows and trusts. But that's all, so far."
"And it's enough," Grey Harbor said flatly.
"No, Father, it isn't," Tyrion disagreed. "I'm afraid events are going to force me to do something I wanted to avoid, but this isn't exactly something I never planned for."
"What do you mean?" Grey Harbor demanded, his voice suddenly taut.
"I mean I'd hoped the only person I'd have to kill would be Caleb." Tyrion shook his head in what appeared to be genuine regret.
"I didn't want to do even that much.
Maybe if I had, I would have planned better."
"You admit you planned to murder your own cousin? Your crown prince?"
Grey Harbor sounded as if he couldn't believe it, even now.
"It was my idea," Tyrion acknowledged. "Lahang was nervous. He and Narmon didn't want anything to do with it at first, but Narmon came around when I pointed out that I was Jean and Jeannette's regent."
"And the king?"
Grey Harbor's voice was no longer taut. It was leached of emotion, flattened, and yet fascinated.
"That would have been more difficult," Tyrion admitted. "On the other hand, I felt reasonably confident Narmon would be so enthusiastic, shall we say, after Caleb's death, that I could trust him to make a respectable effort to remove Harald as well. I'd have preferred that, actually."
"Well, it isn't going to happen now," Grey Harbor said.
"No, not that way. But I do have my own friends in the palace, and I am the king's cousin. I'm afraid it's going to be much messier this way, but this Merlin fellow of yours will help make it work for me."
"What are you talking about?"
"It's simple," Tyrion smiled thinly. "I'm afraid there are about to be several murders here in Telesburg tonight. Wave Thunder, Sea Farmer, most of Sea Farmer's senior investigators. Since I don't know which of them he's talked to, I'll have to attend to all of them. And Lahang will have to go, too. I can't have anyone who knows about my association with him or Narmon."
Grey Harbor's expression was appalled, less because of what he was hearing than because of who he was hearing it from.
"Everyone will be horrified when they hear the news," Tyrion continued. "Fortunately, you will have come to me tonight and warned me of your suspicions about this Merlin. Your fear that he's actually in the employ of Narmon himself, part of some plot against the crown. Your concern that the king has given his trust too quickly, allowed this stranger too close to him and to Caleb by naming him one of Caleb's personal guards. Given your obvious concern about him, the moment I hear about the murder of Wave Thunder and so many of his most senior investigators, I'll immediately go to the palace with my own most trusted guardsman. Obviously, if Merlin really is guilty of all you think he is, it will be essential to arrest him before he can do any more damage. Unfortunately, as everyone knows from his rescue of Caleb, he's a very gifted swordsman and, as it turns out, assassin. His entire reason for saving Caleb from his own employer's assassins was to get him inside the palace, where he could kill all of Harald's immediate family. By the time my guardsmen and I can reach him, he and the other members of Harald's own palace guard he's managed to suborn will have murdered the king and the Crown Prince. My guardsmen and I will, of course, kill the traitors in the guard and manage to save Jean and Jeannette's lives, and I'll immediately proclaim a regency in Jean's name." "That's insane," Grey Harbor said almost conversationally. "No one would believe it."
"I think differently," Tyrion smiled again. "Some of my friends at court would be prepared to support me, whatever happened. Others, even if they doubt all the circumstances, will see Harald and Caleb dead, Jean a mere child, and enemies surrounding us on every side. If not me, then who? Or do you think they'll embrace the dynastic civil war with Narmon and Hector waiting to pounce? And who knows anything about this Merlin? He's a stranger, a foreigner who appeared under mysterious circumstances and who's been busily worming his way into the king's favor. Half the nobles at court probably already fear the influence he might come to wield, and none of them know him. They'll be happy to see the last of him. Especially," his smile disappeared and his eyes narrowed, "when Harald's own first counselor confirms the reasons for my suspicion of him."
"I won't do it," Grey Harbor said flatly.
"I think you should reconsider that, Father." There was no threat in Tyrion's voice, only a tone of reason. "Who will you support if Harald and Caleb are dead? Will you stand to father a civil war? Simply hand the kingdom over to Hector and Narmon? Or will you do what's best for Karis and support the only person who can hold the kingdom together? You told me my only chance was to turn King's evidence for Harald. Well, I'm telling you that your only chance to serve the kingdom is to turn King's evidence for me."
"Never."
"Never is a long time, Father. I think you'll probably reconsider, given enough time to think about it." Grey Harbor started to stand up, then gasped in astonishment as a heavy hand pushed him firmly back down in his chair. His head snapped around, and he looked over his shoulder, eyes widening, as George Howard looked back at him.
"I'm sorry, Father," Tyrion said, and Grey Harbor's eyes whipped back around to him. The Duke shook his head and continued with that same note of sincerity.
"I'm afraid I realized a day like this might come. Have you forgotten Georges was in my service before yours? That I was the one who recommended him to you when you first retained him, not to mention putting in a good word for him when your last guardsman suffered his accident?"
"My God," Grey Harbor half-whispered. "You've been planning this that long?"
"In a manner of speaking, I suppose. And when you appeared so unexpectedly in this sort of weather, I took a few additional precautions." Tyrion took a small bell from the mantelpiece. "I didn't truly expect to need them, but I believe in being prepared." He shook the bell once. Its voice was sweet, rising clear and sharp in an interval between thunderclaps, and the library door opened instantly. Frank Johnson and 14 other members of Tyrion's personal guard filed in through it. The library was a huge room, but it was well populated with bookshelves and scroll racks, and the 15 armed and armored men completely filled one end of it.
"I never planned for this actual moment," Tyrion continued. "And, whether you believe this or not, Father, I love you. I'll admit that I never planned on that in the beginning either. Jennifer, yes, but you were already First Counselor. I had to think of you in tactical terms, and, as I say, I believe in being prepared. Since I couldn't take a chance on how you might jump at a moment like this, I took precautions. Wisely, it would appear."
"It doesn't change anything," Grey Harbor said. "Your entire so-called plan is insane, but even if it works, I won't support you. I can't."
We'll see about that. And I hope, for many people's sake, that you're wrong. In the meantime, however, I'm afraid it's time to...
Lightning flared, thunder crashed again, and on the heels of that deep, rumbling roar came another crash. The crash of breaking glass as the skylight above Grey Harbor shattered into a thousand glittering pieces and a rain-soaked, black-clad figure in the cuirass and mail of the Royal Guard came plunging through it. The intruder landed with impossible grace, as if the 25-foot plunge from the roof above had been a mere 2 feet. His knees straightened, and the drawn sword in his hands hissed. George Howard staggered back with a high-pitched sound of shocked agony, left hand clutching the stump of his blood-spouting right forearm as the hand which had been on Grey Harbor's shoulder thumped to the library's floor.
"Your pardon, Your Grace," Merlin Athrawes said politely, "but I trust you'll understand if I take exception to your plans."
Calvin Armagh stared in shock at the dripping apparition before him. Merlin's abrupt, totally unexpected arrival had stunned every person in that library, Grey Harbor not least, and Merlin smiled thinly. He hadn't planned on this confrontation, hadn't wanted anything remotely like it, in fact, nor had he anticipated any likely need for it. But at least he'd been worried enough over how his accusation of Tyrion might work out that he'd kept an eye on Wave Thunder. He'd planted snark-deployed parasite bugs in several places in Telesburg by now, and he'd monitored the one in Wave Thunder's office on a real-time basis. That was the only reason he'd known about Sea Farmer's conclusions, or the fact that Wave Thunder would discuss those conclusions with Grey Harbor. He'd maneuvered the office bug onto Wave Thunder's shoulder for the trip to Grey Harbor's townhouse, then dropped it off onto the Earl instead. But he'd been slow to realize what Grey Harbor had intended to do. In fairness, the Earl probably hadn't known what he was going to do before he started drinking so heavily, and he'd already summoned his carriage for the trip before Merlin realized where he was going. The fact that Merlin had been dining with Caleb at that moment had made things even more difficult. Fortunately, it had been a private dinner, and he'd managed to disengage himself from the prince rather more hastily than protocol would normally have permitted by claiming, accurately as it happened, that he was even then receiving a vision. The Crown Prince had accepted his newest bodyguard's excuse that he needed to retreat to his chambers to meditate upon the vision, and Merlin had retired with a hasty bow. He'd also instructed Owl to retrieve the recon skimmer even before he took leave of the prince, and given the quantity of thunder rumbling around the sky to disguise any sonic booms, the skimmer had made the trip at better than Mach 4. The moment it arrived, the AI, at his command, had used its tractor to snatch Merlin from his chamber window and deposit him on the roof of Tyrion's Telesburg mansion instead. The trip through the wind-lashed rain and thunder, supported only by the tractor while lightning flared and hissed, had been an experience Merlin could have done without indefinitely. Unfortunately, he'd had no choice but to make it. He'd arrived, still listening to the bug on Grey Harbor, about the time Tyrion handed his father-in-law the brandy glass, and he'd been almost as dumbfounded as Grey Harbor himself by Tyrion's calm admission of guilt, and by how long the Duke had been an active traitor. As Merlin himself had told Harald and Caleb, he couldn't see the past, and he'd had no idea Tyrion had been plotting against his cousins for so long. Which brought him to the present rather ticklish moment, confronting the King of Carus's first cousin and 15 of his hand-picked guardsmen in the Duke of Tyrion's library.
"Take exception to your plans." The Earl of Grey Harbor sat paralyzed in his chair, looking at the back of the man who'd exploded out of the night. The man he'd distrusted and resented,
who stood now between him and 15 armed men in the service of a traitor and would-be regicide. "It would seem," his son-in-law said after what seemed a small eternity, "that I've underestimated you, Sajin Merlin." Grey Harbor could scarcely believe how calm Calvin sounded. The Duke couldn't possibly really be that collected, that poised, or possibly he could. Whatever else, the Earl knew now that the man he'd thought he knew was in fact a total stranger to him. "I could say the same, Your Grace," Merlin replied with another of those thin smiles. The Sajin stood quite still, his body language almost relaxed, ignoring the man whose hand and wrist he'd amputated as Howard went to his knees and his blood spread in a coppery-smelling pool. The Sajin's own sword remained ready in his hands, in a stance Grey Harbor, no mean swordsman himself, had never before seen, and danger radiated from him like smoke as thunder rumbled and rolled overhead yet again.
"Certainly," Tyrion said, "you're not foolish enough to believe you can somehow rescue my father-in-law and get out of this house alive."
"I'm not?" Merlin sounded almost amused, Grey Harbor realized with a fresh sense of disbelief.
"Come now,"
Tyrion actually chuckled as his guardsmen moved slowly and carefully, placing themselves between him and Merlin.
"There's no point pretending, I suppose. The way I see it, the only two choices you have are to join me or to die. I'll admit, in light of my previous underestimation of your capabilities, that you'd make a formidable ally. On the other hand, I'd already planned on killing you, so," he shrugged, "it won't break my heart to stay with that solution if you choose to prove stubborn. Before you make that decision, though, I'd suggest you consider it carefully. After all, what do you think the odds are of your managing to defeat 15 of my best?"
"Better than average," Merlin replied, and attacked. Frank Johnson was a veteran of the Royal Carisian Marines. He'd served for over 8 years before he'd been recruited by a much younger Calvin Armagh to become a sergeant in the Duke of Tyrion's personal guard. He was as hard-bitten, capable, and dangerous as he was loyal to his patron, and the men he'd assembled in response to Tyrion's hasty note, armored in the same cuirasses and mail hauberks as the royal guard, were his best. Every one of them was a veteran as well, and there were 15 of them. They'd heard the wild rumors about Merlin's rescue of Crown Prince Caleb. They'd listened to all the tales, all the gossip, but they dismissed them as the sorts of absurdity to be expected when ignorant farmers or soft city merchants got together to discuss the shivery, shuddery details of such gory goings-on. They'd seen too much, done too much themselves, to be taken in by that sort of heroic fantasy. That was unfortunate, because it meant that despite all the potential warnings, they had not the least idea what they faced in that moment. And because they didn't, the last thing they'd expected was for a single, outnumbered madman to attack. Grey Harbor lunged up out of his chair in disbelief as the lunatic sprang forward. The Earl, too, was a veteran of far more combat than most, and the man who'd captained his own cruiser had summed up the odds against Merlin as quickly as Tyrion or Johnson, which meant the Sajin's sudden attack surprised him just as badly. But however insane it might be, the Earl couldn't let Merlin face such odds alone. Not when he knew it was his own unforgivable stupidity which had led the Sajin here to his death, and not when Grey Harbor's own survival might prove one more weapon against the king whose trust he'd betrayed by coming here in the first place. His hand fell to the hilt of the gem-encrusted dress dagger at his hip. It was a pretty toy, but no less lethal for its decoration. The finely tempered steel scraped from its sheath, and then he froze, jaw dropping. Merlin released the governors he'd set on his reaction time and strength, and his katana flashed with literally inhuman speed as he bounded a single long pace forward. The first guardsman never had time to grasp what was happening. His head leapt from his shoulders before he realized he'd seen the blade move, and Merlin's wrist turned as he brought the blade flashing back across in a flat figure eight. Another head flew before the first victim's knees had even begun to buckle, and then Merlin recovered, still with that impossible speed and precision, and drove the katana's chisel point straight through a third guardman's cuirass, breast and backplate alike. He twisted his blade, withdrew it, and leapt backward, recovering his original position and stance, all in the same flashing movement, before the first corpse had hit the floor. Calvin Armok's eyes went wide in disbelief as Merlin Athrawes savaged his guardsman like a kraken rising hungry from the depths. One instant, the Sajin was standing there, smiling at him. The next, the library exploded in blood, and then, suddenly, Merlin was back exactly where he'd been 2 seconds before, but he faced only 12 opponents. Jansen and the other guardsmen froze. It wasn't cowardice, wasn't panic, it was simple surprise, and even that wasn't their fault. For just a moment they stared at their three dead fellows, the water-dripping apparition which had killed them, and the blood spreading across the library's parquet floor in a tide of crimson. Then,
"Spread out!"
Jansen barked, and the survivors moved forward, fanning out to envelop their single opponent. Grey Harbor was at least as astonished as anyone else. He'd never imagined such speed and power, but he realized almost instantly that however lethal the Seijin might be, he faced one fatal disadvantage. He was trying to protect Grey Harbor. He was like a single war galley, anchored to the defense of a fat, lumbering merchantman, while a dozen scruffy pirates lunged and dashed at his charge. Not one of them could hope to face him in single combat, but they didn't need to do anything so foolish. As long as he was tied down protecting the Earl, Tyrion's men could choose their moment and coordinate their attacks, and there was nothing Grey Harbor could do about it. Even if he'd been properly armed, he would only have gotten in Merlin's way, and he knew it, however humiliating admitting it might be. But if he couldn't help, then surely there had to be some way he could at least...
"Look to yourself, Seijin!"
he barked, and leapt directly away from the cautiously advancing guardsman. Tyrion cursed as his father-in-law sprang for the wrought iron spiral stair to the balcony catwalk that served the library's upper rows of shelves. The Duke had installed that whimsically ornate creation as a gift for his wife on their third anniversary. Jennifer Armok loved books at least as much as her husband or father ever had, and she laughed in delight at the absurdity of his surprise. Not that it hadn't been practical as well. Certainly it was more convenient for someone in long skirts than the steep, rolling ladders it had replaced. One of the Duke's guards recognized the Earl's intent quickly enough to lunge forward, trying to grapple with the older man before he reached the stair. But his effort brought him into Merlin's reach, and the Sajin's sword licked out with that same blinding speed. It bit effortlessly through flesh and bone, blood exploded in a hot, stinking fan, and the guardsman went down with a wailing scream as razor-sharp steel sheared through the thick bone of his femur as cleanly as an axe and amputated his left leg 3 inches above the knee. The other guards were slower to react, and Grey Harbor raced up the ornamental treads, dagger shining in his hand. From its top, he could hope to hold off even a sword-armed opponent, at least briefly. More importantly, it got him out of the reach of any immediate threat. Tyrion's remaining guardsmen realized what that meant almost as quickly as the Duke had, and their cautious advance became a sudden rush. They surged forward through their fallen fellows' shrieks, seeking to engulf Merlin before he took advantage of his sudden mobility. But, quick as they weren't quick enough. Merlin made no effort to evade them. He came to meet them. Captain Yawence of the Royal Carisian Navy had been no stranger to combat, and the Earl of Grey Harbor recognized carnage when he saw it. But he'd never imagined anything like this. Tyrion's guardsmen tried to swarm over Merlin, but it was like a school of herring trying to swarm a kraken. The Sajin seemed to stride forward almost casually, but his peculiar sword was a blur of motion. It moved literally too quickly for the eye to follow, and armor meant nothing before its impossible sharpness. Bodies and bits of bodies flew away from him in gory sprays of blood, and the peaceful library became an abattoir. Men screamed and cursed and died, and Merlin Athrawes moved through the chaos untouched, dealing death like the Archangel Shuler himself. Calvin Armok was no coward, but an icy wave of fear washed through him. Like his guards, he'd discounted the wild rumors and speculation about Merlin. Now, as he watched his men go down, some of them screaming in agony, most dead before they hit the floor, he knew he'd been wrong. He knew the ridiculous rumor that the mysterious foreigner was a Sajin was true after all, and that all the preposterous tales, all the stupid heroic ballads and children's stories about Sajin and their superhuman powers weren't preposterous at all. His surviving guardsmen, all six of them, were no longer advancing to envelop Merlin. They were falling back, huddling together. None of Tyrion's guards had ever lacked courage, but this was too much, something beyond their experience or comprehension. They hadn't panicked, even now. There hadn't really been time for that, but the deadly sense of how totally outclassed they were had driven them completely onto the defensive, and, even as Tyrion watched, another of them fell to Merlin's implacable blade.
"He's not human!"
The thought flashed through the Duke's mind, and he shook himself, fighting to throw off his own incipient panic. His brain raced, and he drew a deep breath. There was still a way, if he could only get out of the library before Merlin reached him. Willems was out there somewhere, and surely the clash of steel, the screams, had to have alerted the majordomo. He must have already sounded the alarm for the rest of Tyrion's personal guards. If the Duke could reach those guards first, he could tell them how Merlin had exploded out of the night in an effort to assassinate him, how the supposed Sajin had taken Grey Harbor hostage. However deadly Merlin might be, Tyrion had the next best thing to another 60 men ready to hand, and most of them were as well trained with bows or arbalests as with swords. And if, in the process of retaking the library, there should be a tragic accident, or if Merlin should cut the Earl's throat rather than allow him to be rescued, or... Yet another guardsman folded up around the bitter steel buried in his belly, and Tyrion turned. A corner of Merlin's attention saw the Duke turn and race for the library's door. He realized instantly what Tyrion had in mind, but there were still four guardsmen between him and the traitor. He couldn't kill them quickly enough to... The Earl of Grey Harbor's belt dagger flashed in the lamplight as it flew across the library. It was heavy, awkward, and not really properly balanced for throwing, but the Earl's hand had not forgotten the captain's skill entirely, and grief and terror had burned the alcohol out of his system. Calvin Armagh, Duke of Tirion, rose on his toes like a dancer, arms flung wide, spine arched, and mouth open in agony as 10 lethal inches of steel drove into his back. A jeweled hilt blossomed between his shoulder blades, blood sprayed from his lips, and he crashed face down to the floor. 12. Brady Lehang's Lodgings, Telesburg. The pounding on Brady Lehang's door was furious enough to wake him, despite the tumult of the storm. His immediate reaction was one of panic. No spy wanted to hear an official fist battering on his door in the middle of the night, and he could think of very few non-official errands which might bring someone out on a night like this one. But then his panic eased just a bit. When Baron Wavethunder's agents came to call on a suspected spy, they were seldom so polite as to bother to knock. Doors had a way of becoming splinters in the course of their visits, although on the rare occasions when they demolished the wrong person's door, they were very good about replacing it later. Still, it was unlikely that whoever was knocking at his door was here in any official capacity, and he felt his heartbeat slow just a bit as he climbed out of bed. He'd selected his lodgings not simply because they were close to the heart of the city, or even because of the roof space available for his wyvern coops. Those were factors, of course, yet an even more important one was the fact that the building's ground floor was occupied by a ship chandler during the day, but empty at night. That gave Lehang a certain degree of anonymity on the occasions when he was expecting callers after hours. He'd made a few additional judicious modifications, without benefit of discussion with his landlord as well, and he paused well to one side of his second-story door and peered through the inconspicuous peephole he'd bored through the wall. There was no lamp in the hallway or on the stairs. Since there wasn't normally any traffic after dark, there was no point risking the accidental fire an unattended candle or lamp might lead to. But Lehang's visitor had brought a bullseye lantern, and Lehang's eyebrows rose as he recognized the other man by the light streaming from its opened slide. His initial alarm returned, if in a rather less acute version. Morris Willems had delivered several messages to him over the past few years, and Lehang was aware that Duke Tirion trusted his majordomo's discretion implicitly. But Willems had never arrived in the middle of the night without warning, or without any of the signals Tirion and Lehang had devised to alert one another that they needed to make contact. Unexpected messages like this, especially ones which carried such a risk of exposure, were only marginally more welcome to a spymaster than the heavy-handed minions of the crown. He drew a deep breath, opened the door part way, leaving the safety chain latched, and peered out.
"What?"
he asked, his voice harsh.
"I have a package from the Duke," Willems replied.
"Well, hand it over,"
Lehang said briskly, extending his hand through the gap.
"It won't fit," Willems said reasonably, and drew a fat package wrapped in oilskin against the weather out from under his streaming poncho.
"What is it?"
Lehang asked, already reaching to unlatch the chain.
"He didn't tell me," Willems shrugged. "There's been some trouble at the townhouse, though. I wouldn't be surprised if it's documents he needs to get rid of."
"Trouble?"
Lehang's eyes sharpened, and he opened the door fully.
"What kind of trouble?"
"Nothing we can't handle, I think," Willems said, handing him the package.
The spy took it almost absently, his eyes so focused on Willems' face that he never noticed the majordomo's hand sliding back under his poncho until it reemerged with the dagger. Even then, Lehang didn't really notice the blade. In fact, he still hadn't seen it when it severed his throat in a steaming gush of blood. Prince Narman's chief agent in Karras thudded to the floor with a dying gurgle, and Willem stepped back, grimacing as he regarded the spray pattern on the front of his poncho. Well, no matter, he thought. The rain would wash away the stains quickly enough, just as Lahang's death would wash away the information about Willem's true patron which he might have provided to Wave Thunder's investigators. Now all Willems had to do was get back to Emerald himself. 13. Privy Council Chamber, Royal Palace, Telesburg. Harald the Seven's face was hard and grim, a mask of angry discipline over grief. His son sat beside him at the huge table in the lamp-lit council chamber, and Caleb's expression was even more mask-like than his father's. Both of them watched, silent and hard-eyed, as Merlin and the Earl of Greyharbor stepped through the chamber's door. Benjamin Race also sat at the table, accompanied by Sir Rizard Seafarmer. Neither Bishop Michael nor any of the Privy Council's other members were present, and Merlin wondered whether that was a good sign or a bad one. At least the king seemed prepared to maintain Merlin's low profile for the moment. The royal guards had been courteous when they'd followed Greyharbor's coachman back to Tyrion's mansion in obedience to the Earl's urgent summons, but they'd also been very, very firm. It was hard to blame them, really, considering the blood-spattered and body-littered scene which had greeted them in the recently deceased Duke of Tyrion's library. Being found standing over the bodies of the king's first cousin and 15 of his personal guardsmen had to come under the heading of suspicious conduct, after all. At least they had been summoned by the Earl, and Lieutenant Hunter, the youthful officer who'd accompanied the squad which had responded, had been willing to at least tentatively assume the First Counselor knew what he was doing. That willingness had taken a hit when Hunter discovered just exactly whose dagger was planted in the Duke's back. But it had been sufficient to at least ensure that the house would be sealed and that the entire matter would be kept secret until the king himself had been informed. That was as far as the lieutenant had been willing to go, however, and, First Counselor or not, Greyharbor had found himself placed ever so politely under arrest. To Merlin's amusement, as much as anything could be amusing under the circumstances, the young guardsman had been almost as courteous to him as to the Earl. Both of them, however, had been relieved of all weapons before they were escorted to the council chamber. "Owl," Merlin subvocalized now. "Communications and telemetry check."
"Communications link confirmed in normal operation, Lieutenant Commander," the AI replied. "All skimmer telemetry links are nominal," it added, and Merlin nodded mentally. He hoped things weren't going to turn out badly, but that didn't mean they weren't. It was always possible, however unlikely, that Harald might order their immediate execution, and Merlin couldn't let that happen. Not only would it be very inconvenient for him personally, but it would also mean the complete failure of Namu Alban's mission on Safehold. That was why the recon skimmer was hovering directly above the royal palace, despite the rumbling thunderstorm. And it was also the reason the skimmer's weapons were fully online under Owl's control.
"Your Majesty," Lieutenant Hunter said quietly, "Earl Greyharbor and Lieutenant Athrawes." "Thank you, Lieutenant."
Harald's voice was harsh-edged, the courtesy automatic, and he never so much as glanced at the guardsman.
"Leave us, please, and see to it we're not disturbed." "As you command, Your Majesty," Hunter murmured.
He withdrew, and the massive council chamber door closed quietly behind him. The metallic clack of the latch was loud in the stillness, and then, as if on cue, another thunderous rumble of thunder shook the palace.
"So," Harald said after a long, still moment, "I've spoken to Benjamin. I've spoken to Lieutenant Hunter. I've spoken to the most senior of Calvin's guardsmen we could find.
Now I want to know what in Shanwei's name happened.
His voice was hard, colder than Merlin had ever heard it, in person or through one of his snarks, and his eyes were chips of brown ice.
Your Majesty,
Grey Harbor went down on one knee and bent his head before his monarch. Merlin saw Caleb's eyes widen, but Harald's expression didn't even flicker.
Whatever happened was my fault,
the First Counselor said, his voice low-pitched and sad, but firm.
I will determine who was at fault, Harald told him, not you.
Your Majesty, Wave Thunder began, but Harald held up a hand abruptly.
No, Benjamin, he said coldly. I'm not exactly pleased with you at this moment either, you know. But I want to hear what Regis and Sejin Merlin have to say for themselves without any excuses from you.
Wave Thunder settled unhappily back in his chair, mouth shut, and the king's eyes bored into the kneeling Grey Harbor.
Why do you say it was your fault? He demanded. Because it was my stupidity which created the situation from which Sejin Merlin was forced to rescue me, Grey Harbor said unflinchingly. The Sejin warned Benjamin and me that Calvin was a traitor. I refused to believe it. Indeed, I went so far as to believe, to insist, that Merlin was lying for purposes of his own. Even when Benjamin came to me, told me what Sir Rizard had already discovered, I refused to believe. And, because I did, I violated my oath as First Counselor. Instead of maintaining the secrecy of the information Benjamin had shared with me, I went to Calvin to tell him he was under suspicion, that he had to disassociate himself from the men we knew were Emerald agents, that he had to come to you, Your Majesty, tell you everything, prove Sejin Merlin's accusations were lies. But
he looked up at last, his face wrung with pain and his eyes glistening with unshed tears.
They weren't lies.
The chamber was still, a frozen tableau, as the kneeling father-in-law met the cousin's eyes. The silence stretched out for several seconds, almost a full minute, and more distant thunder grumbled quietly in the background. Then, finally, Harald's nostrils flared as he inhaled deeply.
How do you know they weren't?
He asked very, very softly.
Because Calvin admitted it to me, Your Majesty.
Grey Harbor's voice wavered at last, frayed by remembered pain.
He admitted it?
Harald repeated, as if, even now, he simply could not believe his own ears.
Your Majesty, he admitted that the attempt to assassinate Caleb was his idea originally, not Narman's. He told me he should have been king, not you. And because I'd revealed that he was under suspicion, he'd planned to murder you and Caleb this very night, rather than face the disgrace and dishonor his crimes had earned. He actually believed he could steal the throne for himself, if only you, Caleb, and Benjamin and his senior investigators were dead, and he invited me to join him in this treason. I don't believe it,
Harald said flatly, but Merlin heard the tiny tremor in that hard voice's depths.
Your Majesty, I'm talking about my son-in-law, Grey Harbor said,
his own voice and eyes wretched.
My daughter's husband, the father of my grandchildren. I loved him as if he'd been the son of my own body. Loved him so much I violated my oath to you to warn him he was under suspicion. Do you think I would lie about something like this? Something which will hurt Xenifer so terribly? Do you think I would kill my own grandchildren's father if I'd had any choice at all?
Harald stared down at him, and the king's frozen expression began to change. His jaw muscles clenched into hard, defined lumps, then relaxed as his cheeks sagged, and he closed his eyes at last. A single tear trickled down his right cheek, and the hard, angry shoulders sagged.
"Why, Regis?" he asked hoarsely. "Why didn't you and Benjamin come to me as soon as Sajin Merlin spoke?"
"Benjamin, because he didn't want to hurt you, Your Majesty," Greyharbor said softly, "and I, because I refuse to believe."
"And now this."
Harald opened his eyes once more and shook his head.
"Now this, Regis. You're right. It is your fault. And you did violate your oath when you went to warn a possible traitor he was suspected. If you hadn't, if you'd waited, as you should have, Calvin would still be alive. We might yet have learned a great deal from him, and he would have been alive. My cousin, almost my brother, would have been alive."
The Earl bent his head once more, and his shoulders shook, but he said nothing in his own defense.
"May I speak, Your Majesty?" Merlin asked quietly, and the king's eyes darted to his face. For a moment they flashed with fiery anger, but then Harald made himself stand back from that instant automatic rage.
"Speak,"
he said curtly.
"Your Majesty, I told Baron Wavethunder and Earl Greyharbor I had no positive proof of my suspicion of the Duke. Yet, had I possessed that proof, I would have laid it in their hands. I would not have laid it in yours."
Harald's eyes glittered dangerously, but Merlin continued steadily, meeting the king's angry glare.
"He was your cousin, Your Majesty. You loved him, and I knew it. It wasn't my place to tell you something which would cause you so much pain, and even if it had been, I had no idea of the true depth of his treason. I told your ministers what I knew, what I suspected, but even I suspected only a fraction of the full truth, and I had no proof even of that. If they erred in the fashion in which they responded to which I told them, they did so out of concern and out of love of their own. Neither of them was prepared to shirk his duty to the crown to investigate any charge, however absurd, and both of them acted as they did out of their love for you and their desire to spare you pain. Baron Wavethunder initiated that investigation without telling you because he knew how much it would hurt you if the charges proved well-founded, and because he wanted to spare you that pain until and unless he knew they were. And also, at least in part, to protect your relationship with your cousin, should those charges not prove valid, by arranging things so that you could blame him for proceeding without your authority if the Duke proved innocent and learned he'd been suspected. And while the Earl flatly refused to believe the Duke could possibly be a traitor, he agreed with Baron Wavethunder, out of his duty to you, that the charges must be investigated. If he acted unwisely in other ways, that, too, was out of love, love for you and for his own son-in-law. Perhaps they should have told you immediately. Perhaps I should have. But if we had, how would you have reacted? Would you have believed it? Or would you have done precisely what the Earl did? Given the cousin you'd loved the opportunity to disprove the ridiculous allegations being made against him by a foreigner about whom you truly know almost nothing?" The king continued to glare at him for a few moments, but then the fire in his eyes ebbed once again.
"Precisely, Your Majesty," Merlin said softly. "You did love him, as did the Earl. Neither of you would have wanted to believe. And because the Earl refused to believe, he was nearly killed by his own son-in-law, would have been killed if the Duke had decided his death was necessary to advance his own plans.
Do not deceive yourself, Harald of Caris. The cousin you loved planned your son's murder, and yours. Had he become regent for Jean, he would undoubtedly have arranged his death as well, and possibly even Jeannette's, if it had proven necessary to secure his own claim to the throne. If you'd given him the opportunity to clear his name, he would have responded in precisely the same way he responded to Earl Greyharbor's offer, and, quite possibly, have succeeded. Silence hovered once again, and then the king shook himself. He looked away from Merlin, away from the still-kneeling Greyharbor.
"What have you discovered so far, Benjamin?" he asked harshly.
"I fear everything Sejin Merlin's told us about the Duke was true, sire," Wave Thunder said heavily. "His majordomo and at least 23 more of his personal guardsmen managed to disappear before Lieutenant Hunter and his men arrived at the Duke's mansion. The only reason I can think of for them to have done that was because they knew the Duke was a traitor, and they were implicated in his treason. And I fear that at least one of them may have served two masters, and not just the Duke alone."
"What do you mean?" Harald demanded, and Wave Thunder nodded to Sea Farmer.
"I received a report from one of my agents just before Sejin Merlin and the Earl arrived here at the palace, Your Majesty," Sir Rizzard said. "A man who may have matched the description of the Duke's major domo, Maris Willems, went to Brady Lehang's lodgings this evening. The weather is so bad tonight my man couldn't make a positive identification, but because it's so bad, he was also suspicious about why someone might be out in the storm. So, after the visitor left, he decided he should quietly check to be sure Lehang was still there, that he hadn't crept out a back way as the first step in disappearing. What he discovered instead was that Lehang had been murdered."
"Murdered?"
Harald repeated, and there was an almost bemused note in his voice, as if even someone as tough-minded as the King of Caris was beginning to feel overloaded.
"Yes, Your Majesty," Sea Farmer nodded.
"I don't believe the Duke ordered his execution, sire," Wave Thunder said. "I suspect that just as the Duke had inserted his own guardsmen into Regis's service, Naaman had inserted this Willems into the Duke's. He was probably the hidden dagger waiting to remove the Duke at a time of Naaman's choosing, but it would seem he was also charged with removing the one man who could have given us complete details on Naaman's network of spies here in the kingdom. Especially if it appeared the Duke's downfall might lead us to Lehang in turn."
"Langhorn," Harald sighed, and covered his eyes with his hand.
He sat that way for quite some time, then made himself straighten once more, lowered his hand, and looked at Greyharbor.
"Oh, stand up, Regis,"
he half-snapped.
The Earl's head came up once more, and Harald made an unhappy sound, halfway between a snort and something angrier.
"The Sijin's right," he said. "Yes, you were stupid, and you violated your oath. And if you'd told me the way you should have, I would have done something equally stupid. Because, as Sijin Merlin says, I loved Calvin. God forgive me, but I still love him. And he would have used that love to kill me and Caleb, and probably Jean and Jeannette as well."
"Your Majesty, I—" Greyharbor began, but Harald shook his head sharply.
"No, don't say it. You're too valuable to me, to the kingdom, to be permitted to resign your post. And however unwisely—"
the king smiled thinly, tightly at Merlin—
"you may have acted in this instance out of love, certainly you've also given me the strongest possible proof of your own loyalty. Terrible as this has been for me and for Caleb, it will be even worse for you in the days to come. I can't do without a man willing to shoulder that much pain in the service of the oaths he swore to me and to my crown. So stand up, come over here, and sit where you belong. Now!"
Greyharbor hesitated an instant longer, then stood a bit unsteadily, walked across to take his place at the council table, and seated himself. That left Merlin standing alone before the table, and Harald leaned back in his chair and gazed at him,
"And so to you, Sajin Merlin," he said softly. "You carry deadly gifts."
"I regret that," Merlin said unflinchingly. "But I told you I'd give you the truth, Your Majesty."
"You did, and you have."
Harald raised one hand in a little throwing-away gesture.
"I thought truth was what I wanted to hear. Now I know better. It isn't what I want to hear, it's only what I need to hear. It will be a long time before I can truly forgive you, or Regis, or Benjamin, or especially myself, for what's happened tonight. But the truth is that you and Regis have quite possibly saved my life and my children's lives. And whether Calvin's plans would have succeeded ultimately or not, you've unmasked and destroyed the most dangerous traitor in the entire kingdom. And so, even though my heart cries out in anger, you aren't the proper target of that anger."
Merlin bent his head, bowing silently, and Harald gave himself another shake.
"In addition," he continued more briskly, "it would appear you've once again saved a valued servant of the crown from assassination, and against even more formidable odds than before."
He regarded Merlin with an intent expression, his eyes much closer to their normal piercing sharpness.
"I've glanced over Lieutenant Hunter's preliminary report, Sajin Merlin. 15 armed and armored guardsmen, I believe," he said. "And while Calvin may have been a traitor, he was an excellent judge of fighting men. Yet, according to Lieutenant Hunter, you went through 15 of his picked men like a scythe through grass, not to mention arriving, once again, at a most opportune moment."
He paused, obviously awaiting a response, and Merlin shrugged slightly. "As I already told Prince Caleb during supper, Your Majesty, I had a vision of the Earl. It was sufficient to alert me to the danger in which he was about to place himself, but I feared it would be impossible to convince anyone else the Duke was a threat to him or to the crown, or, at least, to convince anyone in time. So I went myself to do what I could." Caleb stirred slightly at his father's side. Merlin glanced at him, one eyebrow slightly quirked, and the young man settled back into stillness.
"You went yourself," Harald murmured,
his attention so focused on Merlin that he paid no heed to the silent exchange with Caleb.
"And how, pray, did you manage to get out of Maritha's tower and off the palace grounds without so much as a single challenge from my reasonably competent guards?"
"Your Majesty," Merlin replied with an easy smile, "the night is dark. It's pouring down rain by the bucketful. I'm dressed entirely in black, and I came to you from the Mountains of Light, where there are many steep cliffs upon which to practice climbing. And, in all fairness to your guards, none of them have the training and other advantages I have." Harald cocked his head to one side, and if he'd still been a being of protoplasm, Merlin would probably have held his breath. So far, nothing he'd said had been an actual lie, and he wanted badly to keep it that way.
"I suppose," the king said finally, slowly, "that when a man can come crashing down through a skylight to a floor 25 feet below him and kill not just 15 armed guardsmen, but 16, including Regis's supposed guardsmen, it shouldn't be surprising if he can also scale palace walls like some sort of human fly. I feel, however, that I really ought to point out to you that you seem to be establishing a very difficult example for the next Sajin to live up to."
"That isn't my intention, Your Majesty," Merlin replied. "In fact, I think it would be a very good thing if we could minimize my own part in this evening's events."
"That might be just a bit difficult," Wave Thunder observed dryly.
"And possibly pointless as well," Harald added.
"Difficult, perhaps, my lord," Merlin replied to the Baron, "but not pointless, Your Majesty, if I may explain."
"By all means, Master Trainer," Harald said,
his tone even drier than Wave Thunder's had been, and Merlin surprised himself with a small chuckle. Master Trainer was a stock character out of the Safeholdian puppet theater tradition, a sort of symbol of yin and yang, although the terms were unknown on Safehold. The name was given to a character within the play who was usually a bumbling conspirator, someone whose elaborate plans always miscarried.
But, in a sort of backhanded joke, it was also the traditional nom de théâtre of the master puppeteer who controlled all of the marionette actors. "Perhaps not Master Trainer, Your Majesty," he said, "but a conspirator of sorts, nonetheless." With the revelation of the Duke's treason and Lahang's murder by Narman's own man, all of Narman's and Hector's other agents here in Karis are going to be in what might charitably be called a state of consternation. All of them, I'm certain, will be wondering if Baron Wavethunder's agents are about to pounce on them as well. And they're undoubtedly going to be wondering exactly how the Baron and his investigators tumbled to the Duke's involvement in the first place. I believe all of us are in agreement that concealing the existence and accuracy of my visions from Narman and Hector is desirable on a great many levels. On the level of grand strategy, keeping your enemies unaware of the advantage those visions offer you will only make them even more advantageous. And it would probably be a very good idea to keep those who wish you ill from looking too closely at any of my other activities as well. On a purely personal level, I would vastly prefer not to have to be perpetually on guard against the horde of assassins I'm sure the two of them would send after me to negate that advantage.
I rather doubt any horde of assassins is going to succeed in killing you, Harald observed. So far, it's been rather the other way around, after all.
Any mortal man can be killed, Your Majesty. I'd like to think it would be somewhat harder to kill me than some, but at the very least, slaughtering assassins in job lots would be fatiguing, not to mention a distraction from all the other things I really ought to be doing.
I see.
For the first time since Merlin and Grey Harbor's arrival, there might actually have been a small flicker of amusement in the king's eyes.
And I'd hate to have you inconvenienced in that fashion, of course. But that brings us to the minor matter of Benjamin's observation about the difficulty in concealing your modest part in this evening's activities.
I'd prefer not so much to conceal it as to downplay it, Your Majesty, Merlin said in a more serious tone. And your decision to name me as Caleb's personal guard may make that easier. If you and Earl Greyharbor are willing, I would prefer for the official version to be that Baron Wavethunder's investigators became suspicious of the Duke after interrogating the single assassin that we captured alive, not because of anything I may have said. After that, the Baron began a cautious investigation, and the Earl reacted much as he actually did, by going to the Duke and suggesting that it was imperative for him to clear his name of any suspicion. However, instead of taking only his personal guardsmen, he requested that I accompany him as well, which I did.
And why precisely did he request that? Harald asked.
Partly to help convince the Duke of the serious nature of the charges, Your Majesty. I was, after all, present when the assassination attempt failed. As such, my presence tonight might have helped to rattle the Duke's nerve, if he'd been involved even peripherally with Narman. And also as an additional witness to anything which transpired.
That sounds a little thin to me, Harald mused, then shrugged. On the other hand, if we all say the same thing, and manage to keep our faces straight while we do it, we can probably make it stand up. So, Regis has gone to visit Calvin, and he's taken you along. And then?
When the Duke was confronted, he responded exactly as he actually did, Your Majesty, except that he'd brought only 5 of his own guardsmen into the library at that time. When they attempted to seize the Earl, his guardsmen and I managed to prevent them from doing so and, in the process, killed or wounded most of them. At which point, the Duke summoned the other 10 men he'd had waiting outside the library door. In the ensuing fight, the Earl's guardsman was killed, but not before he, the Earl, and I, fighting together, had defeated the Duke's men. In the general chaos of the fight, the Duke himself was killed, after which the Earl summoned the Royal Guard, not surprisingly, considering that a member of the Royal House had been killed, and Lieutenant Hunter and his men responded.
"Master Trainer, indeed," Harald said after a moment.
Then looked at Wavethunder and Greyharbor and raised both eyebrows.
It cuts against the grain to turn Georges into one of the heroes of this piece of fiction,
Greyharbor said heavily, and shook his head.
I believed for years that he truly was that loyal to me. It would be hard to maintain a straight face, knowing he was actually a traitor and died a traitor's death.
It may cut against the grain, Regis, Wave Thunder said, but it also just might work. Aside from you and Sir Jin Merlin, the only one left alive who knows what actually happened is probably this Willems, the Duke's major domo. Even he wasn't there for the actual fight, although he does know you arrived without Sir Jin Merlin. He'll undoubtedly report that to Narmin, but there's nothing we can do to prevent that, unless we manage to catch him before he gets back to Emerald, which, frankly, is unlikely to say the least. All the same, I suspect Narmin and Baron Shandir are going to tend to discount the more outrageous rumours about the Seijin, just as we would in their place. So, they're going to know we're covering up something, but they won't know exactly what. And Seijin Merlin and the King are quite correct when they say his ability to see these visions of his will be even more valuable to us if no one else knows he can do it.
I think Merlin and Benjamin have a point, Regis,
Harald said.
And if it helps, think of it this way. Your man may have been a traitor, but this way, his death will actually strike a blow against the very men for whom he actually worked.
Very well, Your Majesty.
Greyharbor inclined his head once more, then gave Merlin a lopsided smile.
And I suppose, under the circumstances, that it's the very least I can do for Seijin Merlin in return for his saving my life, after I'd openly accused him of being a traitor himself.
Then that's settled, Harald said. Benjamin, I'll have a few words with Lieutenant Hunter myself, just to ensure that his final report doesn't disagree with Merlin's creativity.
That would probably be wise, sire. In the meantime, I think Rizzard and I need to get back over to the office and decide which of Narmin's other spies, the Duke, or something we found in his papers, might have implicated. With your permission, I intend to prune back Narmin's network rather severely.
Consider my permission granted,
Harald said grimly, then sat back in his chair and gazed speculatively at Merlin.
Your Majesty, Merlin said politely after several seconds, and Harald snorted.
I was just thinking, Sir Jin Merlin.
Thinking, Your Majesty?
Merlin prompted obediently when the King paused.
Thinking about how predictable and orderly life was before your arrival here in Telesburg. I'm sure that, in time, we'll all adjust, but I hope you won't take it wrongly if I tell you I find myself more than a little terrified when I contemplate the future and reflect upon what's followed in your wake in the space of less than a single 5 day, especially because a part of me suspects the real chaos and confusion is yet to come.
Merlin smiled crookedly and shook his head without speaking. There wasn't much other response he could have made. After all, the King was right. 14. A Private Audience Chamber, Royal Palace, Telesburg. The small presence chamber's door opened. A woman in formal court attire stepped through it, accompanied by two small boys. She was in her mid-30s, possibly a little older, but her figure was firm and trim. The light, flowing drape of the cotton gowns enforced by Telesburg's climate made that abundantly clear, but her face was tight-clenched, her eyes suspiciously swollen under the cosmetics which helped to mask their redness. She walked down the runner of carpet across the cool stone floor, holding the hands of her two sons as they walked beside her. The younger of them, perhaps 5 years old, standard, looked more confused than anything else. He kept glancing up at his mother, worried and concerned by the emotions he sensed from her. The older boy, twice his younger brother's age, was different. He appeared shocked, almost like someone trapped in a terrible nightmare from which he could not awake. Like his mother and his brother, he was perfectly attired, complete to the dress dagger hanging at his right hip. But his eyes were as swollen as his mother's, and Merlin could almost physically feel the concentration it took to keep his lower lip from quivering. King Harald the Seventh watched the small, pathetic procession coming towards him for perhaps 3 heartbeats.
Then he pushed himself up out of his throne and, in a total violation of every rule of court protocol, stepped down from the dais and went to meet them. He moved so quickly his habitual limp was far more evident than usual, so quickly neither of the bodyguards standing behind his throne could keep up with him. Then he reached the widowed mother and the grieving son and went awkwardly, awkwardly, to his good knee, his right leg stretched painfully behind him.
"Regis,"
he said to the older boy, and reached out one hand to cup the back of the boy's head.
Your Majesty,"
the boy began, but then he stopped, eyes gleaming with tears as his voice cracked and he had to fight for control.
"No titles, Regis,"
the king told his first cousin once removed gently.
"Not yet."
The boy nodded mutely, his face crumbling with the grief the king's tone told him it was all right to display, and Harald looked up at his mother.
"Jennifer,"
he said softly.
"Your Majesty,"
she half-whispered. Her voice was more controlled than her son's, Merlin thought, but it was still husky, shadowed by sorrow and tears. Harald looked up at her for a moment, then began to push himself up off his knee.
"Sire?"
Sergeant Charles Gardiner's voice was quiet, but he'd caught up with his king and he held out a mailed arm. Harald grimaced, but he also took it and used it to pull himself back erect. He towered above the two boys, looking down at them for a moment, then scooped the younger up into his own arms. The boy clung to his neck, pressing his face into the king's tunic, and Harald held him with one arm while he extended the other hand to Regis. The older boy looked at that hand for a moment, then he took it, and Harald limped more slowly back to his throne. The king's mouth, Merlin noticed from his place at Caleb's left shoulder, behind the crown prince's flanking throne, tightened each time his weight came down on his right leg. Harald reached the dais, followed by Lady Jennifer Armagh, who had just become the Dowager Duchess of Tirion. He paused, setting the younger boy gently back on his feet, then lowered himself back into his chair and used both hands to lift his right leg until his foot rested once more on the stool before it.
"Jennifer, Regis, Calvin,"
he said then, softly.
"You know why you're here, but before we face the council and all the official details we have to deal with, I need to speak to all three of you as members of my family, not as a king to his subjects."
Duchess Tirion flinched slightly at the word family, and Harald held out his hand to her. She took it a bit hesitantly, and he drew her closer to his throne.
"Don't feel guilty for grieving," he told her very gently. "Don't think I blame you for that, or that anyone ought to. And don't think Caleb and I aren't grieving as well."
She looked into his eyes, her mouth quivering, and his grip on her fingers tightened comfortingly as tears trickled slowly down her cheeks.
"It's going to take us a long time to understand exactly what happened, where the Calvin we knew and loved turned into the man who could have done the things we know now that he did,"
the king continued. He looked back into Jennifer's eyes for a moment longer, then looked down at her older son.
"Regis," he said, "this is going to be hard for you. The hardest thing you've ever done. Some people are going to say horrible things about your father. Others are going to insist those things couldn't have been true. And there are going to be a great many men who believe that because of the things your father may have done, you may somehow become a threat or a danger to the crown someday."
Regis's effort to control his expression wavered, and the king's free hand reached out to cup the back of his head gently once more.
"What's going to make it hurt worst of all," he told the boy, "is that so many of those horrible things are going to be true. If I could protect you from hearing them, I would. But I can't. You're young to be faced with all of this, but no one else can face it for you."
Regis looked back at him mutely for several seconds, then nodded in tight-mouthed understanding.
"In just a few minutes," the king continued,
We're all going to appear before the council, and before Bishop Michael and Bishop Executor Gerald as the church's representatives. They're going to ask you and your mother,
he looked up at Jennifer briefly,
a lot of questions. Some of them are going to make you angry. A lot of them are going to hurt and make you sad. All you can do is answer them as honestly as you can. And I want you to remember, I want all three of you to remember that you are my cousins. Nothing anyone, not your father, not the council, could do will ever change that. Do you understand, Regis?
The boy nodded again, tightly, and Harald drew a deep breath.
There's one more thing, Regis, he said. One thing that's going to hurt worse than anything else, I'm afraid.
Jennifer Armach made a soft, inarticulate sound, and her hand twitched as if she wanted to reach out, stop the king. But she didn't, and Harald continued, speaking slowly and carefully, his eyes on both her sons.
People are going to tell you, he said, that your grandfather killed your father.
Calvin, the younger of the two, jerked, his eyes suddenly huge. Regis only looked back at the king, but his eyes were suddenly darker and filled with even more pain, and Merlin's heart twisted in silent sympathy for the heartbroken boy who'd just become a duke.
The reason they're going to say that, Harald went on, is because it's true. He didn't want to, because he loved your father, just as I did, just as Caleb did. But he had no choice. Sometimes even people we love do bad things, Regis, Calvin. Sometimes it's because there's a part of them we never knew was there, a secret part that wants things they shouldn't have and tries to take them. Your father and I were raised as if we were brothers, not cousins. I loved him the same way Calvin loves you, Regis. I thought he loved me in the same way. Some people will say I was wrong to believe that, because in the end he wanted to steal the crown from me, and he tried to murder Caleb to do it. That was a terrible, terrible thing for him to do. But despite all of that, I wasn't wrong to love him, and I wasn't wrong to believe he loved me. People change sometimes, boys. There are sicknesses that don't affect our bodies, but our hearts and our minds. I believe that's what happened to your father. He wanted the crown so badly, it became a sickness, one that twisted things deep down inside him. When he and I were your ages, when we were growing up together here in the palace, before that hunger for the crown poisoned him inside, he did love me. And he did love Caleb, I believe, just as your grandfather loved him. But when he did what he did, and when he refused to step back from the plans he'd set in motion, your grandfather had to make a choice. He had to decide whether he was going to do the things his oaths to the crown and his own honor required, or whether he was going to join your father in doing the terrible things your father's ambition had driven him to do. And when your grandfather decided he couldn't support treason, no matter how much he loved the person committing it, your father ordered his personal guardsmen to seize him and hold him prisoner until after Caleb and I, and quite a lot of other people, had all been killed.
Calvin was shaking his head again and again, slowly, with a 5-year-old's expression of pain and loss and confusion. Regis was old enough to understand, however imperfectly, what the king was saying, and his chin quivered as the words sank home.
Your grandfather couldn't let that happen, Harald said,
his voice soft but unflinching.
Your grandfather is my first counselor. He's one of my vassals. He was an officer in my navy. And your grandfather understands what honor means, what oaths mean. And so, as much as he loved your father, and he did love him, Regis, I swear that to you, when it came to open fighting, and your father's guards tried to seize or kill him, He honored those oaths and killed the man he loved for the crimes that man had committed.
Both boys were weeping now, and so was their mother. Harald pushed himself back up out of his throne and drew Jennifer into his embrace. A moment later, 2 5-year-old arms locked around his left thigh, and he felt Calvin pressing his face into his hip. Regis stared up at him, his face working with desolation and loss, and the king reached one hand to him. The boy who had just become a duke, and in the process learned how hideously expensive a title could be, looked at his monarch through a veil of tears, and then he took the offered hand in both of his, clutching it as a drowning man might cling to a spar.
"There's a reason your grandfather wasn't here to tell you this himself,"
Harald said, looking down and speaking to Jennifer as much as to her sons.
"He wanted to be. As painful as he knew it would be, he wanted to tell you himself, Regis. But I wouldn't let him. I'm your king, and you're one of my dukes now. There are obligations between kings and their nobles, and the fact that you're also part of my family makes those obligations stronger than ever. It was my duty to tell you, and I wanted you to hear it from me because I wanted you to know in your heart as well as your mind, that nothing that's happened, nothing your father could have done, will ever change the way I feel about you and your mother. God judges all men in the end. Kings are sometimes required to judge men too, but a wise king judges any man or woman only on the basis of their own actions, not those of anyone else. I'm not always wise, however hard I try, however much I pray for guidance. But this much I promise you. When I look at you through the eyes of your cousin and remember your father, it will be the boy I loved, the good man I treasured, that I see in you. And when I look at you through the eyes of your king, it will be the boy you are and the man you become that I see, not the father who betrayed his trust.
Merlin watched Zenefir's face, saw the pain and the loss mingled with the acceptance of Harald's words. And as he saw those things, Merlin knew he'd been right. Kings like Harald the Seventh were what had made Caris a kingdom worth saving.
"Whatever your father may have done at the end of his life," Harald finished gently, "he and your mother and your grandfather taught you and Calvin well first. Remember those lessons, Regis. Always remember them, and honor the man he was when he taught them to you, and you'll grow into a man worthy of anyone's love."
The boy stared up at him, weeping freely now, and the king gave Jennifer one more squeeze, then released her so he could bend over and gather the youthful, broken-hearted Duke of Tirion into a crushing hug of comfort. He embraced Regis for several seconds, then released him and straightened.
"And now, Your Grace," he said quietly to his cousin, "let us go and meet the council."
15. Telesburg Cathedral, Telesburg. The mighty organ's rich, powerful voice filled Telesburg Cathedral with music. The organist's assistants pumped strongly, steadily, fueling its voice, and Merlin Athrawes, Lieutenant Athrawes now, of the Royal Guard, stood at one corner of the royal box as it flowed over him. The circular cathedral was awash in a polychromatic sea of light as the morning sunlight streamed in through the stained-glass clerestory which completely encircled it, and the magnificent mosaic of the Archangel Langhorn and the Archangel Bedard looked out over the congregation with stern eyes. Merlin gazed back at it, meeting those majestic eyes, outwardly calm and composed despite his internal rage. "One day," he promised Pei Shanwei's ghost, "and theirs. One day." He looked away from the mosaic, more to distract himself from the anger he dared not display than for any other reason. Even here, and even today, or perhaps especially today, Caleb and Harald could not be left unguarded, and Merlin was scarcely the only armed and armored guardsman present. Lieutenant Falcon and four of his marines stood between the box and the central aisle as well, and their eyes were just as hard, just as alert as Merlin's, as they surveyed the huge crowd filling the cathedral's pews. As always, the aristocracy and upper class were heavily represented, glittering with jewels and bullion embroidery. At a guess, there had to be at least 2,000 people in the cathedral, enough to strain even its enormous capacity, and there was something odd about their mood. "Well, of course there is," he thought. Given Tyrion's death and the wave of arrests Wave Thunder's launched, everybody in the entire kingdom is probably feeling a little anxious, and none of the nobility could possibly risk missing this service without absolutely ironclad proof that it was literally impossible for them to be here. But still, word of the king's cousin's treason and death had spread like wildfire. Things like that simply didn't happen in Karras, and no one doubted for a moment that they wouldn't have happened now if someone from outside the kingdom hadn't made them. King Harald and his council might not be prepared to name names, but Karizians in general were far more aware of political realities than the subjects of most Safeholdian realms. That was probably inevitable, given the way international politics routinely affected the trade relationships upon which Karras's prosperity depended. Harald might have chosen not to point any fingers, but there was no question in his subjects' minds about who'd been responsible, and Merlin could almost physically taste their rage, like acid on his tongue. Yet there was more to it than anger. There was fear. No, he thought, fear isn't the right word for it either. That's part of it, but there's more to it. These people know there's more going on here than just the routine power games between rival princes, and they're turning to their church for reassurance. A sudden shift in the organ music drew his mind away from its thoughts, and he turned his head as the cathedral's doors swung wide. An acolyte stepped through them, bearing the golden scepter of Langhorne upright before him on a gleaming night-black staff of ironwood bound in rings of engraved silver. Two candle-bearers flanked him, and two under-priests followed them, swinging censers that trailed fragrant strands of incense like white, drifting ribbons in the light of the stained-glass windows. Behind the under-priests came the massed choir in its green cassocks and white surplices. As the first rank passed through the open doors, the entire choir burst into song, and despite Merlin's hatred for all the Church of God Awaiting represented, the beauty of those superbly trained voices washed through him like the sea. It took a long time for the choir to pass through the doors and wend its way to the choir lofts on either side of the archangel's mosaic. Behind them, following them through the storm of music, came Bishop Michael, another dozen acolytes, and half that many priests and underpriests, followed by yet another scepter-bearer and two more thurifers. The bishop paced slowly down the central aisle, his vestments glittering with gems, his usual priest's cap replaced by the simple golden coronet of his ecclesiastic rank. Heads bent in reverent courtesy as he passed, and his expression was serene as he reached out, touching shoulders, heads, the hair of children, in quiet benediction as he walked past them. That, Merlin knew, was scarcely standard practice on the part of Mother Church's bishops, and one eyebrow arched slightly as he saw people daring to touch the bishop in return. He'd known Michael Stainer was deeply respected here in Telesburg. Until this morning, he hadn't realized how deeply the bishop was loved. The bishop entered the sanctuary and genuflected before the altar and its mosaic. Then he stood, turning to face the congregation while his assistants made their way to their own places. It was all as precisely choreographed as any formal ball, and the last acolyte found his position at the same instant the final note of the processional hymn died. There was utter silence for a moment, and then Bishop Michael's superbly trained voice rang out in the stillness.
May Langhorne be with you, my children.
And with you, my father, rumbled back at him.
Let us pray for the intercession of Langhorne and the guidance of God upon our worship this day,
Michael said, and turned once more to face the altar and dropped to his knees.
Our Father who is in heaven, he began, blessed be your name. May the day awaited come. May the law proclaimed in your name by the blessed Langhorne be done on Safehold as it is in heaven. Give us...
Merlin tuned it out. He had to. Nemu Alban had been raised in the church. She had not, perhaps, been as observant as her parents and religious instructors might have desired, but she discovered here on Safehold that it had stuck. Now, as he listened to the utter sincerity in Michael Stainer's voice, Merlin reminded himself the bishop had been taught from childhood to believe in the teachings of the Church of God Awaiting. It was hard to remember as the words which had meant so much to Nemu were perverted to Langhorne's purposes, and yet it was true. And how could Merlin condemn a manifestly good and caring man for honoring the belief system in which he had been raised? None of which made it any easier to stand by and watch. Merlin was just as glad Langhorne had decided to build the Safeholdian year around a 5-day week, which no longer included Saturday or Sunday, and established the middle day of those 5 as his church's holy day instead. Simply attending at all was hard enough without doing so on Sunday. It had to be the greatest irony in the history of mankind, he thought. The last Christian in the entire universe was a machine. Legally, that was all even an autonomous Pika had ever been, although Merlin had long since ceased to apply that legal definition to himself. Still, it was a question he wished he could have discussed with someone else. Was he, in fact, the human being whose memories he possessed? Or was he simply an echo, a recording, an AI with delusions of grandeur? And did he have the immortal soul in which Nemu Alban had always believed? Or had Nemu taken that soul with her at the moment of her biological body's death? He had no answer to any of those questions. For a time, he'd even wondered if a being of Molly Cirques and alloy had any right to so much as ask God about them. Then he decided God must be able to understand what impelled his questions, just as he decided that the fact that the Church of God Awaiting was an enormous, obscene lie could never shut God's ears to the sincerity of the prayers rising about him even now. But he did know he had another responsibility, over and beyond any duty to prepare the surviving human race to meet the Gababa again one day. He was the last surviving Christian. In a sense, he was also the last surviving Muslim, the last Jew, the last Buddhist, Hindu, Shintoist. The library computer in Nemu's cave was the final repository for millennia of human religious thought, of human striving for divine inspiration, and Merlin Athrawes was the only being who knew it was there. Someday, that repository would be opened, for that too was Merlin's responsibility. He was the protector and guardian of Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Buddhism, all of them, and whether he was merely a machine or not, it was one of his tasks to restore that rich, varied heritage to the humanity from whom it had been stolen. He only hoped that when that day came, the human race's ability to believe would not have been destroyed by the realization of the lie which had enslaved it for almost 1,000 years. It was a mass of thanksgiving, not a funeral mass. Under the doctrine of the Church of God Awaiting, traitors were forbidden burial in holy ground. Or, at least Merlin corrected himself, proven traitors were forbidden, which was probably just as well. From his own observations to date, at least a quarter of Safehold's aristocracy, and probably as much as half of its vicars, would otherwise have been buried outside the cemetery wall. But the definition of traitor, unfortunately, by his own admission, applied to Calvin Armagh, once Duke of Tirion. That had been hard on Harald and Caleb. Despite everything, as Harald had told Jennifer Armagh and her sons, they'd loved their cousin. To be denied the right to bury him in the church, to be forced to have his body interred on unconsecrated ground, had caused them both enormous pain. Yet they'd had no choice. Not even Bishop Michael could change that for them, however much he might have longed to. But what he could do, he had. The Mass thanked God for preserving the lives of the king, the crown prince, and the kingdom's first counselor, but the sermon which accompanied it focused on the fallibility of humans and the cost of sin to others.
And so Shanwei did not lead men into evil by appealing to their evil nature.
Merlin gritted his teeth, his expression calm, as Michael's voice reached out to every corner of the vast cathedral with a projection any trained actor would have envied.
The writ tells us that not even Shanwei herself was evil to begin with. Indeed, she was one of the brightest of all the archangels. And when she herself had fallen into evil, it was not man's evilness to which she appealed, but his goodness. She tempted him not with power over his fellows, not with dominion, but with the promise that all men everywhere would partake of the power of the archangels themselves, that their children, their wives, their fathers and mothers, their friends and neighbors would all become as God's own angels if they simply reached out their hands to what she promised them.
And so it is that even good men can unwittingly open the door to evil. I do not tell you, my children, that there are no evil men. I do not tell you that those who turn to betrayal, to theft, to murder and treason, do so only because they are good men who have been led astray. I tell you only that all men begin as good men. What they are taught as children, what is expected of them as young men, is either the armor about that goodness, or the flaw that allows evil in.
Merlin rested one hand on the scabbard of his katana and gazed straight ahead. The bishop's voice was compassionate, caring, and yet everything he'd said was straight out of the Church of God Awaiting's doctrine and theology. But then...
Yet we must not forget our responsibility to teach them correctly. To discipline when discipline is required, yes, but also to use gentleness and love whenever we may. To be sure that that which we discipline is, indeed, a wrongful act. And to teach our children to know wrong from right themselves. To teach them to judge with clear eyes and unclouded hearts, fearlessly. To teach them it does not matter who tells them something is right or wrong, but whether or not it is right or wrong. To teach them the world is a vast and wondrous place, one which holds challenges, promises, and tasks fit to test the mettle of any mortal. To teach them that to truly know God, they must find him in themselves, and in the daily lives they live.
A stir went through the cathedral, more sensed than seen, and Merlin twitched at the unanticipated direction of Michael's text. It was a small thing in many ways, but not here, not in a sermon from the third-ranking prelate in all of Caris. The Church of God Awaiting acknowledged a personal relationship between God and each of his children, but it did not encourage those children to seek that relationship. It was the function of the Church to teach and inform, to decree to the faithful what God's will for them was, and define their personal relationship with him for them. The writ did not specifically proclaim the infallibility of the Church as it had that of the archangels, but the Church's doctrine did extend that same infallibility to the vicars who were heirs to the archangel's authority. Michael had not openly assailed that doctrine. What he'd said was simply an argument that even the best teachers could fail. But that was also an argument that those teachers could be wrong, and so his words could be interpreted as an attack upon the infallibility of the Church, which was every Safeholdian's teacher, especially here in Caris, where independence of thought was openly encouraged.
"We strive to teach all our children those lessons," the bishop continued calmly, as if completely unaware he'd said anything at all out of the ordinary. "And sometimes, despite all our efforts, we fail. There is evil in the world, my children. It can be found anywhere among any men, and it waits patiently, and its snares are cunning. Men, powerful or weak, nobly born or common, wealthy or poor, fall into those snares, and thus into sin. And it is our responsibility as God's people to hate sin, to reject it and cast it out when it arises among us. Yet it is also the responsibility of God's people to love one another, to hate the sin, but love the sinner, and not to feel guilt or self-hatred because we do love the sinner. It is meet and right that we should give thanks this day for the preservation of our king, our crown prince, and our first counselor. It is meet and right for us to condemn and hate the crime of treason which threatened them, and, through them, all of us. Yet even as we give thanks, let us remember that the evil which threatened them and was thwarted still claimed its victims from among us. Those who fell into temptation's grasp and lent themselves to these evil actions are as lost to us as Crown Prince Caleb would have been had their plan succeeded. What they've done will forever mark their memory among those who love them, and the price for their immortal souls will be higher than any of God's children should be called to pay. And so I beseech you all, as you join me in our closing prayer of thanks, to pray also for the souls of all who have perished, and for the wounded hearts of those who loved them.
He gazed out over the cathedral's silent pews for perhaps 10 seconds, then drew a deep breath and turned back to face the altar and the enormous faces of Langhorne and Bedard as he raised his hands in prayer. Merlin looked at the bishop's sword-straight spine as the words of Michael's prayer flowed over him. He hardly even heard the actual words, although Apika's perfect memory would recall them later, if he wanted to. But the important words had already been said, and Merlin wondered if Harald and Caleb had suspected where their bishop's sermon was headed.
16. Archbishop's Palace, Telesburg.
"Perhaps you would care to explain the text of your sermon, Bishop?"
Bishop Executor Gerald Adamson inquired icily, turning from the window of his study to face his guest.
"Forgive me, Your Eminence," Michael Stainer said calmly, "but I'm not certain what part of the text you're referring to."
His eyes met the Bishop Executor's stony gaze levelly, and Adamson's fists clenched in the flowing sleeves of his cassock. He'd never been happy about Stainer's accession to the capital C. The man was too Carisian. But Harald's stubborn insistence on nominating the priest of his own choice to the empty throne in Telesburg Cathedral had given the previous archbishop pause. He could have rejected the nomination. As far as Adamson was concerned, he damn well ought to have rejected it, and the bishop executor had said so at the time. But the archbishop had flinched from the king of Caris's adamantine will. Archbishop Roger had been old and tired, already fading. He'd wanted only peace for his final years in the archbishopric, and perhaps he'd feared that if he pressed Harald too hard, it would create a situation which would force the Council of Vicars and the Inquisition to act.
And so, instead of dealing with it himself, he left it to fall into my plate, Adamson thought bitterly. I have been told, he said to Michael now, that your sermon called into question the primacy and authority of Mother Church.
Your Eminence, Michael said, his expression one of total innocence, I'm afraid I simply can't conceive of how anything I may have said might have called Mother Church's legitimate primacy and authority into question. What portion of my sermon could have led anyone to think for a moment that such was my intention?
Adamson's fists clenched more tightly, and his nostrils flared as he inhaled deeply.
Did you or did you not say that it was the responsibility of any godly individual to decide for himself what constitutes right or wrong?
Of course I did, Your Eminence.
Michael's surprised tone couldn't have been improved upon by the most skilled of actors, Adamson thought.
Isn't that what both the writ and the commentaries teach us? That God and the archangels, his fingers touched his heart, then his lips, expect all of us to be armored against evil? That it's our duty as godly men and women to be eternally upon our guard, and to recognize evil for ourselves when we see it?
Adamson's teeth grated as his jaw muscles tightened. He wanted to reach out and slap the bland-faced Carisian in front of him. Both of them knew what Michael had really been saying, yet the bishop's glib response was drawn directly from the church's most central doctrines.
I don't disagree with the statement that God and the archangels,
it was Adamson's turn to touch his heart and then his lips,
expect us to recognize evil when we see it. But it's dangerous, both in a doctrinal sense and in terms of maintaining Mother Church's legitimate authority, both in this world and the next, to suggest her teachings may be in error.
With all due respect, Your Eminence, but I said nothing of the sort, Michael asserted firmly. I spoke of a parent's responsibility to teach his children to recognize right from wrong, and to be wary, alert to the fact that others, less responsive to their obligations, or for their own evil and corrupt purposes, may attempt to mislead them, to couch false arguments in terms of acceptable beliefs. I never suggested that Mother Church might fall into the error of false teaching. If you believe I've done so, I beg you to instruct me as to where and how I might have set forth such an unforgivable accusation.
Adamson glared at him for a moment, then wheeled back to the window while he fought to get his own expression and temper back under control.
Whether or not you intended that accusation, he said finally, your words, as reported to me, could be interpreted in that sense by those inclined to set up their own judgment in opposition to that of Mother Church.
I assure you, Your Eminence, that I've never had any intention of questioning Mother Church's legitimate authority. If any words of mine could be interpreted in that fashion, I do most humbly apologize.
Adamson continued to glower out the window. The sun was settling steadily into the west. The western horizon was a solid mass of crimson coals, reaching out to paint Howell Bay with an ominous tinge of red, and the bishop executor drew another deep breath.
I am most displeased with the evident carelessness of your choice of words, Bishop Michael. You are, after Archbishop Erech and myself, the senior bishop of the entire kingdom of Caris. You have a responsibility to God and to Mother Church to remind the sheep of your flock where their duty and the safety of their souls lie. And it follows that you have an equal responsibility to avoid inadvertently driving potential wedges between them and the safety afforded by Mother Church's authority.
He made himself speak calmly, reasonably, although he knew perfectly well that neither he nor Stainer had any doubt that the Carisian bishop had done precisely what Adamson had accused him of doing. But, by the same token, Stainer had covered himself. His interpretation of what he'd meant, however inaccurate and self-serving it might be, sounded both plausible and reasonable, or would have, anywhere except here in Caris.
"I regret that you have reason to feel displeased with me, Your Eminence," Stainer said.
"I'm sure you do."
Adamson smiled out the window without any humor at all. Technically, he had the authority to remove Stainer temporarily from his see. Without Archbishop Erech's agreement, he couldn't remove the Carisian permanently, however, and he wasn't at all certain the Archbishop would support him.
"And that's partly your own fault, Gerald," he told himself coldly. "You've known for years how stubborn these Carisians are, and yet you've persistently assured the Archbishop that the situation was under control. You've downplayed the reports of people like Hector and Narmon as exaggerations, because they are exaggerated, wildly, dammit, for too long. If you simply report Stainer's words now, after all that, and accuse him on that basis of seeking to undermine the Church's authority, you'll sound as if you're starting to exaggerate as well. Without seeing the man's face, listening to his tone, sensing the mood of his parishioners, everything he said will sound completely reasonable, and any allegations you may lay against him will sound hysterical and alarmist."
The bishop executor's smile turned into a glare as he gazed at the smoldering horizon and wondered if that crimson pile of cloudy embers was an omen of some sort. Stainer was worrisome, of course, but that was at least partly because of the composition of the Carisian priesthood in general. One huge reason Stainer's elevation to the Tellisburg See stuck in Adamson's craw was that it flew in the face of the Church's normal policy of moving and assigning senior clergy, especially bishops and auxiliary bishops, so that they served outside the kingdoms or provinces of their birth. It was never a good idea, in Adamson's opinion, to allow the leadership of the local church to develop a feeling of loyalty to the secular realm it served. As far as he was concerned, that was particularly true in lands such as Caris, which were so far from the temple and Zion. But convincing members of the priesthood to move to such distant and isolated hinterlands was always difficult. Those with patrons of their own could always find some way to weasel out of it. While Caris's wealth offered a certain level of enticement, the truth was that assignment here was regarded as exile. At the best, it would be a severe blow to the potential career of anyone sent here. Adamson's own case was atypical. He'd amply demonstrated his reliability, but he lacked that necessary patronage at the very highest level to ever become an archbishop in his own right. Since that was the case, Caris had suited him just fine when it was offered. It was far enough from the temple and Zion to give him a degree of independence and autonomy, plus manifold opportunities for acquiring personal wealth. But better than 9 out of every 10 members of the church's clergy here in Caris were Carisian-born, just like Stainer. The numbers were higher in the lower ranks of the priesthood, and among the various monastic orders, of course, but that was the very thing which made admitting a Carisian to the 3rd highest church office in the entire kingdom so worrisome. Those lower-ranking priests and under-priests were undoubtedly listening to anything their bishop said.
"I'll accept your assurance that you didn't intentionally assail Mother Church's authority and right to declare error," he said finally, turning back to face Stainer after several silent moments. "That doesn't abate my displeasure, however. Nor, I feel sure,
Would the Council of Vicars or the Inquisition be pleased by the potential for error contained in your unfortunately chosen words? You aren't some simple parish priest. You're a bishop, one of Mother Church's bishops, and as such you will be rightly held to a higher standard. Is that understood, Bishop Michael?
It is, of course, Your Eminence, Stainer said, bowing his head very slightly.
These are perilous times, Ardamson continued levelly. Danger threatens Caris on many levels, as, indeed, the treason of the king's own cousin clearly illustrates. Do not increase that peril.
I'll take your warning to heart, Your Eminence, Stainer said with another slight bow.
See that you do, Ardamson said. Be very careful to see that you do. Neither my patience, nor the Archbishop's, nor the Office of Inquisitions is without limit. If your failure in your duties leads to consequences for others, then the weight of those consequences will be upon your own immortal soul, and Mother Church will demand an accounting of you.
Stainer said nothing, but neither did he flinch, and there was no give in his steady eyes. Well, he'd been warned, and whatever else the man might be, he wasn't a fool. That would have to be enough, for now at least.
You may go, Ardamson said coldly, and extended his ring for Stainer to kiss.
Thank you, Your Eminence, the Bishop of Telesburg murmured, as he brushed his lips lightly across the golden scepter inlaid into the blood-red ruby of the ring. I assure you that I'll remember everything you've said to me today. September, Year of God, 890. 1. Madame Angelique's, City of Zion. Archbishop Erech Dinis smiled happily as he bade Madame Angelique Fonda a heartfelt good night.
As always, it's been a delightful evening, Angelique, he said, patting her delicate, perfumed fingers between both of his own well-manicured hands.
You're always too kind, Your Eminence,
Madame Angelique said with the gracious smile which had been so much a part of her success during her own working days.
I'm afraid you flatter us more than we really deserve.
Nonsense, nonsense, Dinis said firmly. We've known one another far too long for me to stand on ceremony or worry about polite nothings with you and your charming ladies.
In that case, thank you, Your Eminence.
Madame Angelique bent her head in a small bow.
We're always delighted to see you, especially now. We weren't certain we'd have the chance to entertain you again before your departure for Caris.
Not something I'm looking forward to be honest.
Dinis sighed with a small grimace.
Of course, I can't delay much longer. In fact, I should already have left. The first snows have fallen in the mountains, according to the semaphore's reports. It won't be much longer before Sing Wu's passage starts to freeze, and I'm afraid the voyage itself won't be very much fun this time of year, even after we clear the passage.
I know, Your Eminence. Still, they say summer in Telesburg is much more pleasant than winter here in Zion, so at least you have something nice to look forward to at journey's end.
Well, that's certainly accurate enough, Dinis agreed with a chuckle. In fact, I sometimes wish the archangels hadn't been quite so immune to the effects of waist-deep snow when they chose the temple's site. I love Zion's climate in the summer, you understand, but winter is something else again entirely, even, alas, despite your own charming company.
It was Madame Angelique's turn to chuckle.
In that case, Your Eminence, and in case I don't see you again before you leave, allow me to wish you a comfortable voyage and a safe return to us.
From your lips to the archangel's ears.
Dinis touched his heart and then his lips, smiling into her eyes, and she rose on tiptoe to kiss him chastely on the cheek.
It was, he reflected through a pleasant glow of memory, the only chaste thing which had happened to him since entering her door several hours before. Madame Angelique's door was one of the more discreet portals in all of Zion. When the Holy Writ recognized that human beings were fallible, and that not all of them would seek the approval of Mother Church's clergy upon their relationships, it was quite strict on the subjects of fornication and infidelity, which complicated Eric Dennis's life somewhat, since both the writ and the church's own regulations also required that any churchman who aspired to the ranks of the episcopate must have married. How else could he understand the physical and emotional needs of the wedded believers for whose spiritual well-being he was responsible? Dennis himself had, of course, met that requirement, although he very seldom saw his wife. Adderai Dennis was neither surprised nor particularly unhappy about that. She'd been only 12 when the Dennis and Lenore families arranged the marriage, and she'd been raised to understand as well as Dennis did how such matters were handled among the church's dynasties. Besides, she hated Zion's world of social activity almost as much as she disliked the complex maneuvering of the temple's internal factions. She lived quite happily on one of Dennis's estates, raising horses, chickens, draft dragons, and the two sons she had dutifully borne for him in the early years of their marriage. That left Dennis, like many of his peers, at loose ends for feminine companionship. Fortunately for him, Madame Angelique and her unfailingly lovely and exquisitely trained young ladies were available to fill the void. Always, of course, with the utmost discretion.
Ah, well, Angelique,
he sighed now as she escorted him the last few feet to the door and the dignified porter opened it at their approach.
I'm afraid I truly do have to go.
Not, he said with a shudder, which wasn't entirely feigned, as he gazed out the open door at a fall night's cold, drizzling rain.
Without more regrets than you can possibly imagine.
Flatterer!
Madame Angelique patted him on the shoulder with a peal of laughter.
Of course, if the weather is too bad, you could always stay the evening, Your Eminence.
Get you behind me, Shanwei!
Dennis quoted with an answering chuckle, then shook his head.
Seriously,
he continued, watching the steamy plumes of his coachman's and horse's breath rise into the rainy night under his coach's lamps as they awaited him at the curb.
I'd be most tempted to take up your gracious offer. Unfortunately, there are a great many matters which require attention before I can depart for Corus, and I have several meetings scheduled early in the morning. But for that, I feel sure you could easily convince me.
In that case, Your Eminence, I accept my defeat.
Madame Angelique gave his hand another squeeze, then released it and watched him step out the front door. No one, least of all Dennis, was entirely certain later exactly what happened next. The porter bowed the archbishop through the door, accepting the heavy golden weight of a coin with a murmur of thanks. From his perch high on the carriage box, Dennis's senior coachman watched his employer's approach with undisguised gratitude. However pleasant the archbishop's visit might have been for him, the long wait had been cold, wet misery for the driver, his assistant, and the blanketed horses. The assistant coachman holding the horses' heads felt much the same thing, plus a twinge of envy for the way his seated senior partner's voluminous cloak formed a well-draped tent about him. Madame Angelique's footman and lantern boy went scurrying ahead of the archbishop, lighting his way and ready to open the coach door for him. And Dennis himself settled his thick, fur-lined cloak and started down the broad, smooth steps with his eyes half-squinted against the blowing rain. That was when his feet went out from under him. literally. Dennis had never experienced anything quite like the sudden tugging, almost snatching sensation. It was as if a hand had reached out, grasped his right ankle, and pulled on it powerfully. It staggered him, and he was not, unfortunately, a particularly athletic man. The Archbishop flailed his arms with a most un-Archbishop-like squawk of astonishment as he fought for balance. But that tugging sensation didn't let go as he squawked again, louder, as his feet went out from under him and he tobogganed down the steps. Had he considered it, he might have found it odd that he went down feet first instead of head first, which, in turn, might have caused him to think rather harder about that peculiar pulling sensation. At the moment, however, he was too busy falling to ponder such matters as they perhaps deserved, and he cried out as he hit the cobbled walkway at the bottom of the tall steps. He slammed across it until the avenue's raised granite slab curb abruptly stopped him and sent a bolt of anguish ripping through his right leg and shoulder. Madame Angelique's horrified servants raced after him, and the assistant coachman abandoned his place at the horses' heads to dash towards him. The Archbishop shook his head groggily, scraped and bleeding and more than half stunned by the ugly, slithering tumble. Then he tried to stand up and cried out again, more loudly, as the injudicious attempt sent waves of pain washing through him. "Don't move, Your Eminence!" the assistant coachman said urgently, going to his knees beside the prelate. "You've broken at least one leg, sir." The young man had already ripped off his own cloak. Now he spread it over his fallen patron and looked at Madame Angelique's footman.
"Fetch a healer," he snapped. "His Eminence is going to need a bone setter at least."
The white-faced servant gave a single, jerky nod and went dashing off into the night, even as Madame Angelique came scurrying down the steps. Her face was twisted with genuine concern and dismay as she held a filmy evening cloak over her elaborately coiffured hair and knelt beside the coachman in her flowingly draped silk gown.
"Don't move, Eric," she said,
not realizing his servant had already given him the same command. She let one hand rest lightly on his chest.
"I can't believe this happened. I'll never forgive myself for it, never."
Not your fault,"
Dennis told her through gritted teeth, touched by her manifestly sincere worry, despite his own pain.
"Slipped. Must have been the rain."
"Oh, your poor leg,"
she said, staring at the obviously badly broken limb.
"I sent for a bone setter, my lady,"
the assistant coachman told her, and she nodded jerkily.
"Good. That's good."
She looked up over her shoulder at her porter, who had followed her down the steps and now stood at her shoulder, wringing his hands.
"Starving,"
she said sharply.
"Don't stand there like a ninny. Get back in the house. I want blankets out here at once, and a pillow for the Archbishop's head. Now go!"
"Yes, ma'am,"
the porter said, and turned to flee back into her establishment in obedience to her commands. Merlin Athrawes stood atop the roof of an elegant townhouse across the street from Madame Angelique's. He'd been waiting there for the better part of 3 hours, and he'd come to the firm opinion that he'd spent entirely too much time loitering on rooftops in the rain. Since he seemed to have acquired the habit, however, he was just as glad that at least a pika didn't have to feel the cold and wet if it didn't want to. He was also glad no one and nothing appeared to have noticed him so far. He'd hoped it would work that way, yet he'd had significant reservations about this entire operation. Unfortunately, he'd also come to the conclusion it was necessary. His recon skimmer hovered discreetly out of sight, well to the north of the city of Zion, hiding under every stealth system it possessed, while its passive sensors watched over the emission signatures Nemu, Alban, and Owl had detected in their first sweep of the temple and its environs. The fact that those emission signatures existed still made Merlin extremely uneasy. But he'd come to the conclusion that Nemu's initial hypothesis, that most of the signatures his skimmer was reading were those of the temple's still-functioning environmental systems, had been correct. Certainly the temple was mystically warm and inviting, despite the increasingly unpleasant weather outside it. Given the local winter climate, that particular miracle had to be one of the Archangel's more welcome dispensations, he reflected. There were still a few other more powerful signatures Merlin couldn't account for, though, and a part of him wanted to get even closer, take a better look. But prudence suggested otherwise. Whatever they were buried beneath the temple itself. And while he devoutly hoped they were merely more of the temple's heating and cooling systems, there was simply no way to tell that. And until he had at least some clue about exactly what those emissions represented, or until he had absolutely no other choice, he wasn't prepared to push for additional information. There were always those orbiting kinetic bombardment platforms to think about. Poking his nose, even by electronic proxy, where any computer controlling the platforms might decide it didn't belong, could have unfortunate consequences. It was frustrating, to say the very least. If there was one organization he needed to keep close tabs on, it was the Council of Vickers. But unless he'd been prepared to deploy snarks, or at least their parasites, dangerously close to those unidentified emission signatures, there was no way to snoop upon the Council's meetings. What made that especially worrisome was that even from his less risky coverage of the more junior archbishops and bishops living in Zion, it was clear the Council was growing increasingly restive about Karis. So far, it seemed, that restiveness had yet to attain critical dimensions, but Merlin was coming to the conclusion that he'd rather badly underestimated its underlying strength in the first place. He'd gradually become aware that discussion of Karis cropped up much too often in his snark's coverage for his peace of mind. In private conversation between the church's senior prelates, as well as in more official settings, and there was a hard edge to many of the discussions he'd overheard. In point of fact, the church hierarchy's apparent level of concern was out of all proportion to the size and population of the kingdom. He was beginning to suspect the church was better aware than he'd originally believed of the potentialities he himself had sensed in Karis, and Karis's many enemies, led by Prince Hector and Prince Narman, were fanning the fire as energetically as they dared. The fact that the church's suspicions of Karis seemed to be at least as much emotional as reasoned played into Hector's and Narman's hands. They had to exercise some caution. Their own distance from the temple left their own orthodoxy open to a certain degree of automatic suspicion of its own, especially in the eyes of the Office of the Inquisition. But neither Hector's Coruscant nor Narman's Emerald had produced anything like Karis's innovativeness. Their agents in the temple were carefully emphasizing that fact as they spread exaggerated tales of King Harald's willingness to skirt the fringes of the prescriptions of Zhuozheng, coupled with observations about Harald's willingness to overturn the existing social order, all backed by sizable cash donations. Somewhat more sophisticated, or at least discreet, techniques might be required to sway the vicars themselves, but the more junior ranks of the episcopate, and, perhaps even more importantly, the priests and underpriests who provided the council's staff functions, and who were thus ideally positioned to shape the way those tales were presented to their superiors, responded quite well to simple bribery. So did more than one of the council's own members, apparently, and Hector and Tomas's efforts were slowly but steadily gaining ground. Archbishop Erech was as aware of that as anyone. It had been apparent from his discussions with his fellows and the instructions he'd been issuing to Father Mateo that he'd recognized he would be expected to look very closely at the situation in Telesburg during his annual pastoral visit. The Council of Vicars obviously wanted to hear his personal assurance either that the rumors it was hearing were wildly overblown or that the Archbishop of Carus had taken the necessary steps to correct any problems. That, unfortunately, couldn't be permitted, because just this once, Harald's enemies were underestimating exactly what one Merlin Athrawes had in mind for the Kingdom of Carus. He had no intention of actually violating the prescriptions, not yet, but that distinction might well be lost upon an archbishop intent on satisfying the demands of his ecclesiastical superiors, which was why Merlin came to be standing on this miserable, rain-swept roof on a bone-chilling autumn night. Fortunately, Zion was a very large city, and Madame Angelic's establishment was in an expensive and exclusive section of it, almost 5 miles from the temple proper. That gave him a certain comfort zone where unidentified energy signatures were concerned, as long as he was discreet, and he discovered he could be very, very discreet when the need arose. Now he listened via the remote riding in a fold of Dennis's cloak, and nodded with satisfaction. He had nothing personally against Dennis, yet at least, and he felt pleased satisfaction as he eavesdropped on Angelic and Dennis's assistant coachman. The archbishop's injuries were undoubtedly painful, he reflected, as he packed away the handheld tractor unit he'd used on Dennis's feet, but it didn't sound as if they were life-threatening. That was good. Merlin didn't want to get into the habit of casually killing people he didn't have to kill, and overall, he preferred Dennis to a potentially more doctrinaire and rigorous replacement. On the other hand, it was obvious the archbishop's right leg, at least, was badly broken. Probably his right shoulder as well, judging by what Merlin's light-gathering systems could see from here and what he could overhear. Dennis would be a long time recovering. By the time he did, Sing Wu's passage would certainly be frozen over for the winter, and Merlin rather doubted anyone in the temple would expect the archbishop to make the arduous winter overland journey to Clonir and cross the cauldron, especially so soon after such a nasty accident and injury, which ought to delay Dennis's pastoral visit for at least another 5 or 6 Safeholdian months. Long enough for me to get things up and running and erase my own fingerprints anyway, I hope, he reflected. At any rate, it's the best I can do for right now. And I need to be getting back home. He chuckled inside at the thought. It was broad daylight in Carus at the moment. He'd told Harald and Caleb, truthfully enough, that he needed some time in privacy to deal with certain aspects of his visions. The king had agreed to allow him to seek solitude in the mountains near Telesburg while he did so, although it was obvious Harald was none too happy about the thought of allowing Merlin out on his own and unprotected. Caleb, on the other hand, had merely looked thoughtful, extremely thoughtful, when Merlin made his request, and Merlin wondered exactly what was going on in the Crown Prince's mind. Whatever it was, the sooner Merlin got home to deal with it, or to divert the prince's suspicions, as the case might be, the better. He climbed very quickly down from his rooftop perch, arranged his poncho about himself, pulled up its hood, and strode briskly away. Owl would be waiting to collect him with the skimmer's tractors, but not until he'd put at least 10 more miles between himself and the temple. At least, he reflected sardonically, he'd have the city streets pretty much to himself on a night like this. 2. Royal Palace, Telesburg. Crown Prince Caleb raised his hand to knock courteously, then paused just outside the half-open chamber door. One eyebrow rose as he listened to the quiet, crisp clicking sound. It came again, then ceased, then began yet again. The prince frowned, wondering what fresh novelty he was about to encounter, then shrugged and continued his interrupted knock on the doorframe. "Come in, Your Highness," an amused voice invited an instant before his knuckles actually contacted the wood, and Caleb shook his head with a crooked grin and pushed the door fully open. He stepped through it into Merlin Athrawus's comfortable, sunlit sitting room and paused just inside the threshold. In keeping with his official position as Caleb's personal bodyguard, the Sajin had been moved from Maritha's tower to quarters in the royal family's section of the palace. In fact, they were quite near Caleb's own, with a view of the harbor that was almost as good as the one from the prince's bedchamber, although they were considerably more modest. The Sajin had risen respectfully from his chair behind a desk at Caleb's entry. Now he stood there, clad in the kraken-badged livery of the House of Armagh, head cocked, with a quizzical smile of his own. His sword and the matching short sword were racked on the wall behind him, and Caleb smiled slightly as he glanced at them. The longer of the two swords was unlike anything anyone in Karras had ever seen before. It was also, apparently, unlike anything anyone had ever seen in Harchong, judging from Master Domnek's reaction at least. The armsmaster was obviously being eaten alive with curiosity about the Seijin and his weapons, but his Harchongese pride refused to let him ask the questions burning within him. The crown prince shook his head and looked away from the sword rack, and one of his eyebrows quirked. There was a peculiar device on Merlin's desk, a rectangular wooden frame, about 2 feet long and 6 inches tall. 21 vertical rods connected the upper and lower sides of the frame, and there were 6 flattened beads on each rod, 5 below and 1 above a wooden dividing strip near the outer frame's upper side. The beads on the rods were arranged to slide up and down, and their present configuration formed an obviously deliberate, if incomprehensible, pattern. There were also several sheets of paper on the desk, covered with the Sajin's strong, clear handwriting, but also with columns of some sort of symbols or characters Caleb had never seen before. "Oh, sit down, Merlin," the prince said, crossing the chamber to him. The Sajin only smiled more quizzically still, then waited until Caleb had seated himself in the chair in front of the desk before sitting once more behind it. Caleb shook his head and snorted. "I thought we were supposed to be leaving for Helen this afternoon," he said. "We are, Your Highness," Merlin agreed. "Catamount's been delayed, though. The page taking you a copy of his note probably passed you on your way here. We won't be leaving for at least another hour or so, so I thought I'd spend the time jotting down a few notes." "Is that what those are?" Caleb nodded to the neatly inscribed sheets of paper, and Merlin nodded. "What sort of notes?" "Most of them are for High Admiral Locke Island, today at least," Merlin replied. "I've got some already worked up for Dr. Macklin and Master Hausman. I was just completing some calculations on manpower and tonnages, Hector and Narmans, not your father's, for the High Admiral."
"Calculations?"
Caleb leaned back in his chair, then gestured at the rectangular frame on the desk.
"Since you knew it was me outside the door without even looking, you must know I was eavesdropping shamelessly. I imagine that clicking sound I heard came from this thing?"
"Indeed it did, Your Highness," Merlin said gravely, his peculiar sapphire eyes glinting with amusement while the notes of distant birdsong floated through the open window.
"Yet another of your little surprises, I suppose. Just what does this one do, if I might ask?"
"It's called an abacus, Your Highness," Merlin replied. "It's a device for doing mathematical calculations."
"It's what?" Caleb blinked.
It's a device for doing mathematical calculations, Merlin repeated. How does it work? Caleb could hardly believe he'd asked that question, and he felt a momentary stab of panic as he realized he'd laid himself open to the sort of explanation Franklin Thomas, his tutor, had always delighted in administering. Actually, Merlin said with a wicked smile, it's quite simple. Caleb shuddered at the dreaded simple word, but the Sagen continued mercilessly. Each vertical rod represents one integer, Your Highness. Each bead in this group here, above the divider, represents the value of 5 when lowered. Each bead in this group here, below the divider, represents a value of 1 when it's raised. At the moment, he waved a finger at the device's first 4 rods. The setting of the beads represents the number 7,413. Caleb had opened his mouth to disavow any interest in further explanation, but he paused, disavowal unspoken. He had no idea what an integer was, but he'd spent more than enough time working his laborious way through the endless numbers contained in the sort of report Merlin had been preparing for Admiral Locke Island. Surely it wasn't possible to represent a number that high with only 4 rods and 24 beads. You can keep track of numbers that high on something that size? He asked almost incredulously. Or much higher, Merlin assured him. It takes practice, but after you've learned to do it, it's quick and simple. Caleb only looked at him for several seconds, then reached out and drew one of the sheets of notes across in front of him. He glanced down the page and made a soft sound in the back of his throat as he reached one of the columns of peculiar symbols. From the context, it was obvious that they represented the results of some of the calculations Merlin had been making, but they made absolutely no sense to Caleb. "Admittedly, I've never been the most enthusiastic scholar my family ever produced," he said with masterful understatement, looking up at Merlin. "Still, it occurs to me that I've never seen anything like this." He tapped the column with a fingertip. "It's simply another way of writing numbers, Your Highness." Merlin's tone was almost casual, yet Caleb had the definite impression that there was something watchful and focused behind those odd sapphire eyes, almost as if the Sagen had deliberately arranged this moment of explanation. It was a feeling the prince had had before. "Another way of writing numbers," he repeated, and chuckled. "All right, I'll grant you that. Somehow, though, I don't think simply really enters into it," he observed, and in that moment, although he didn't realize it himself, he looked remarkably like his father. "Well," Merlin said, sliding a blank sheet of paper across to Caleb and handing him the pen with which he'd been writing, "why don't you write down the number set here on the abacus? 7,413, he reminded helpfully. Caleb looked at him for a moment, then took the pen, dipped it in the desk's inkwell, and began scribbling down the number. When he'd finished, he turned the sheet around and showed it to Merlin. "There," he said just a bit suspiciously, tapping the number with the end of the wooden penholder. Merlin glanced at it, then took the pen back and jotted 4 of his incomprehensible symbols under it. Then he turned the sheet back around to Caleb. The prince looked down at it. There was the number he'd written, MMMMMMMCDXIII, and under it were Merlin's odd symbols. 7,413. "It's the same number," Merlin told him. "You're joking," Caleb said slowly. "No, I'm not." Merlin leaned back in his chair. "That's ridiculous," Caleb protested. "Not ridiculous, Your Highness," Merlin disagreed. "Only different, and simpler. You see, each of these symbols represents a specific value from 1 to 10, and each column," he tapped the symbol 3, with the end of the pen holder, then tapped the first of the rods on his abacus as well, represents what you might think of as a holding space for the symbol. The wise woman who taught them to me many years ago called them Arabic numerals, which I suppose is as good a name as any for them. There are only 10 symbols, including one which represents nothing at all, called zero. He drew another symbol, which looked for all the world like the letter O on the sheet of paper, but I can write any number you can think of using them. Caleb stared at him. The prince often joked about his own aversion to book learning, but he was far from stupid, and he was also the crown prince of his world's leading maritime power. Record-keeping and accounting were critical to Karras's traders and shippers, and they were also functions which ate up the efforts of huge numbers of clerks with a voracious appetite. It didn't require a genius to recognize the huge advantages of the system Merlin was describing, assuming it actually worked. "All right," the prince challenged, taking back the pen briefly. "If you can write any number using these numerals of yours, write this one." The steel nib of the pen scratched across the paper as he wrote, MMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMM Merlin looked it over for a moment, then shrugged. The pen scratched again, and Caleb's eyes narrowed as Merlin wrote simply, 19,702. "There you are, Your Highness," he said. Caleb stared down at the sheet of paper for several long, silent seconds, then looked back up at Merlin. "Who are you, really?" he asked softly. "What are you?" "Your Highness?" Merlin's eyebrows rose, and Caleb shook his head. "Don't play with me, Merlin," he said, his voice still soft, his eyes level. "I believe you mean me, my father, and my kingdom well, but even though I may still be young, I'm not a child any longer either. I'll believe you're a Sejin, but you're more than that too, aren't you?"
"Why do you say that, Your Highness?" Merlin countered, but his own voice was level, taking Caleb's question seriously.
"The legends and ballads say Sejin may be teachers as well as warriors," the prince replied, "but none of the tales about them mention anything like this." He tapped the sheet of paper between them, then gestured at the abacus lying to one side. "And," he looked very steadily at the other man, "I've never heard any tale about even a Sejin who could cross an entire unfamiliar city through the middle of the winter's worst thunderstorm as quickly as you did.
As I told your father, Your Highness, I was alerted by my vision. You were there at the time I experienced it yourself."
"Yes, I was," Caleb agreed, "and you seemed distracted enough by it that I followed you to your rooms to be certain you'd reach them safely. I got there only seconds behind you, and I thought I heard something from inside your chamber. So I knocked. There was no answer, so I knocked again, then opened the door, but you'd already disappeared. The only way you could have done that was to go out the window, Merlin. I noticed that you'd never actually specifically answered Father's question when he asked you how you'd done it, but I saw no rope ladder you might have climbed down, and the sheets were all still on your bed."
"I see." Merlin leaned back in his chair, gazing steadily at the prince, then shrugged.
"I told you, and your father, I possess some of the powers the tales say Sejin possess, and I do. I also possess some the tales don't mention, some which must be kept secret. I think, hope, I've demonstrated that I do indeed mean you and Karis well, that I'll serve you and Karis in any way I can, and someday, perhaps, I'll be able to tell you more about those powers and abilities I must keep secret for now. I promised your father the truth, and I've never lied, although, as you've obviously noticed, that isn't necessarily the same thing as telling all the truth. I'm not free to tell all the truth, however. I regret that, but I can't change it. So I suppose the question is whether or not you can accept my service with that limitation." Caleb looked back at him for several seconds, then inhaled deeply. "You've been expecting this conversation, haven't you?" he asked. "Or one like it," Merlin agreed. "Although, to be honest, I'd expected to have it with your father or possibly Bishop Michael first." "Father is more confident of his ability to judge men's hearts and intentions than I am," Caleb shrugged slightly. "He's been doing it a lot longer than I have. I think some of the same questions have occurred to him, and he's simply chosen not to ask." "And why should he have made that choice?" "I'm not sure," Caleb admitted. "But I think perhaps it's because he truly believes, as I do, that you mean Caris well, and because he's already guessed there are questions you can't or won't answer. He knows how desperately we need any advantage we can find, and not just against Hector and Narmon, and he's unwilling to risk losing your services by pressing the point."
"And Bishop Michael?"
"Much the same, I think." Caleb shook his head. "I'm never really certain what Michael thinks in a lot of ways. He's a Carisian, and he loves this kingdom. He also loves my father and our family. And even though he's never expressly said it to me, I think he actually fears the temple. He..." Caleb paused a moment, then shook his head. "Let's simply say he's well aware of the way our enemies could use the temple and the church against us, and why. Like father, he knows the trap we're in, and if he says he senses no evil in you, then he doesn't. Which isn't exactly the same thing as saying he has no reservations at all."
"And do you agree with your father?"
"Yes, to a point." Caleb looked Merlin in the eye. "But I will require one answer from you, Sajin Merlin. This," he gestured at the sheet of paper in the abacus once again, "goes beyond visions and attempted assassinations. The services you're offering now will change Caris forever, and eventually they're going to spread beyond Caris and change the entire world. I suspect there are going to be even more changes than I can imagine at this moment. Changes some will fear and hate. Changes some may even argue violate the prescriptions of Zhuozheng, with all the dangers that would entail. I think the thunderstorm you disappeared into was no more than a spring shower beside the typhoon following on your heels. So the one question I have, the one answer I require, is why. You once said many of our enemies serve darkness, whether they realize it or not. But which do you serve, Merlin? Darkness or light?"
"Light, Your Highness," Merlin said promptly, unflinchingly, looking straight into Caleb's eyes. "There's enough darkness in the world already," the Sejin continued, "and more is gathering. Caris stands in its way, and so I stand with Caris. And I tell you this, Caleb Armak, Crown Prince of Caris, I will die before I permit darkness to triumph, whatever its source."
Caleb looked deep into those level sapphire eyes for at least 30 measured seconds, and then, slowly, he nodded. "That's enough for me," he said simply, and tapped the piece of paper once more. "Now," he invited, "try explaining these numerals of yours to me again, if you would."
3. Kings Harbor, Helen Island. Helen Island lay 114 miles northeast of Telesburg in South Howell Bay. It was shaped roughly like a triangle with a bight taken out of its eastern side and measured about 75 miles in its longest dimension. That wasn't particularly huge for a planet like Safehold, where islands were an everyday fact of life, but this island's craggy mountains rose to a spectacular height above sea level. More to the point, perhaps, Helen Island was a vital part of the ancestral Armak lands, and it had been heavily fortified for centuries. Howell Bay had been the key to the evolution of the Kingdom of Caris. Waterborne transportation was faster, easier, and far cheaper than trying to haul the same goods and materials overland, and Howell Bay had provided Caris the equivalent of a broad, straight highway at its heart.
Swift galleys and sailing vessels had tied the growing power of the kingdom together and provided the impetus and seagoing mindset for the oceanic expansion of trade which had followed. And Howell Bay had been dominated by three islands, Sanchol, Helen, and Big Tyrian. The fact that the House of Armagh had managed to secure control of all three of them had a great deal to do with the fact that it had also eventually secured the Carisian throne. That had been centuries ago, but the kingdom of Carris had maintained the fortifications on all three islands, and King's Harbor, Helen's major port, was the site of one of the Royal Navy's main shipyards. King's Harbor was also an ancient fortress, whose walls had been steadily expanded for centuries, which made the shipyard what might be considered a secure location. And the fact that most of the island's usable supply of ship timbers had been logged off long ago wasn't much of a drawback. Timber could always be shipped in, and Helen did offer substantial deposits of copper and iron, plus, despite its relatively small size, enough mountain-borne rivers and streams to drive a great many of Carus's overshot water wheels. The King's Harbor shipyard had installed its first water-powered sawmill over a century before, and a very respectable complex of supporting installations had grown up since. Over the years, more than one project about which the kings of Carris wanted the rest of the world kept in ignorance had been carried out at King's Harbor. The shipyards at Hyratha on Big Tyrian were bigger and more capable in some ways, but Big Tyrian's population was also far higher, which meant security was commensurately more difficult to maintain there. And the Royal Navy's Telesburg shipyard, the biggest and most capable of all, was also the most public. All of which helped to explain why Merlin Athrawes stood on the foredeck of the Royal Carisian Naval Galley HMS Catamount as she rode steadily into King's Harbor, past the towers guarding either side of the opening in the seawall. It was the first time Merlin had seen the harbor with his own eyes, as it were, and he was forced to admit the looming fortifications, standing stark and tall against the dark green and brown of their mountainous backdrop, were impressive, to say the least, when viewed from sea level. On the other hand, they were also about to become hopelessly obsolete, although no one else had any way to know that. He gazed at the sheer stone curtain walls, crenellated and tall, with regularly spaced towers and platforms for catapults and ballistae. Cannon crouched on some of those platforms now, he noted, crudely designed yet well made, then turned his attention to the shipyard itself. Half a dozen galleys like Catamount were under construction, their partially completed hulls already showing the rakish gracefulness of their breed. They, too, were about to become obsolete, and Merlin felt a brief, very brief, stab of regret at the thought of the passing of such lithe, beautiful craft. The fact that he felt unhappily certain he was going to have no end of difficulty convincing some Navy officers that their passage would be a good thing helped to account for some of that regret's brevity. He snorted in amusement at the thought and turned to glance at the young men standing beside him. "Impressive," he said, and Caleb chuckled and looked over his shoulder. "Merlin says it looks impressive, Arnold," he observed. "Do you think we should feel flattered?" "At this point, Your Highness, I sometimes doubt anything truly impresses Sir John Merlin," Lieutenant Falcon said dryly. The Marine had returned to duty less than a 5 day after the assassination attempt, and he'd adjusted remarkably well to Merlin's constant presence at the Prince's side. Some men in his position might have resented the public appearance that such a special reinforcement had required. Falcon, however, knew the real reason for the arrangement, and he seemed remarkably impervious to public appearances. Now he only grinned. "I've noticed, however, that the Sajin is always polite and careful not to hurt his host's feelings," he added. "That's about what I thought, too," Caleb said with another chuckle, and turned back to Merlin.
In this case, I meant exactly what I said, Your Highness, Merlin said. It is impressive, and I can see how it must have aided your ancestors' efforts to unite the kingdom.
My, you are polite, Caleb smiled broadly. My ancestors began as the most successful pirates on the bay, as I'm sure you're quite well aware, Merlin, and I'm afraid their efforts to unite the kingdom had a great deal more to do with improving their opportunities to loot and plunder than with high and noble motivations.
I'm not sure that's quite the way I'd put it, Your Highness, Falcon interjected, with a slightly pained expression.
Of course it isn't. You're a loyal servant of the House of Armark. I, on the other hand, am the House's heir. As such, I can afford to tell the truth.
And I'm sure it amuses you no end, Merlin said dryly. Nonetheless, Your Highness, I do find the sight impressive, and I think it should suit our purposes quite well.
You're probably right, Caleb said more seriously, and pointed off to the right, where several columns of smoke rose from behind another stretch of curtain wall. You'll want to look it over for yourself, I expect, but there's a fairly respectable foundry back there. If I recall correctly, something like half the Navy's guns have been cast there over the years. I realize from what you were saying the other night, he smiled tightly, that we're going to need to expand it, a lot, but it's still a start.
I'm sure it will be, Merlin agreed, without mentioning that he undoubtedly had a far better notion of that foundry's capacity than Caleb himself did. The prince was right about how useful it was going to be, though.
There's the Marie Jane, Your Highness, Falcon put in, pointing at another ship, one of the heavier, clumsier, square-rigged merchant ships which constituted the kingdom's true wealth, and Caleb nodded in acknowledgement.
Was it really necessary to haul everyone clear out here, Merlin? The prince asked as their own galley altered course slightly to steer for the same anchorage.
Probably not from a security perspective, Merlin acknowledged. On the other hand, I think your father was absolutely right about all the other reasons. It's not as if Helen were on the other side of the world. But it's far enough from Telesburg to make the point that he's dead serious about the need to keep this entire meeting secret. And bringing all of them together at once, where they can see how all the bits and pieces fit together, is going to make them all realize how critical it is that they pull together.
But it's also going to mean all of them do know how all the bits and pieces fit together.
Caleb's voice and expression alike were both suddenly darker, more somber.
If it turns out we're wrong about any one of them, he's going to be able to hurt us much worse than if each of them only knew about his own particular piece of it.
Merlin turned fully towards the prince, his own expression grave as he studied Caleb's. Caleb, like his father, had been very close to Culvin Armark. After all, the Duke had been his godfather, not just his cousin. Given the difference in their ages, Caleb had always regarded Tyrion more as an uncle, and, in many ways, a true second father, than as a cousin.
It had been Calvin who'd taught Caleb to ride when Harald's crippled leg prevented him from doing so, just as it was Calvin who'd overseen the beginning of Caleb's training with sword and bow. The prince had loved his cousin, and more than a little of the adoration of a very young boy for a magnificent uncle had stayed with him, which meant the proof of Calvin's treason had hit Caleb even harder than it had hit Harald. In some ways, that was probably a good thing, for someone who would face the burden of kingship himself one day. But it had been a painful, painful lesson, the sort that left scars, and Merlin hoped it hadn't permanently damaged the boy's ability to trust those who truly deserved his trust.
Your Highness, he said gently after a moment, these men are loyal. Baron Wavethunder's vouched for all of them, and so do I. No man's judgment is perfect, but I have no fear that any of the people your father's invitation has summoned to Helen today will ever betray you or Karis.
Caleb scowled for a second or two, then he snorted as he realized what Merlin had really said, and his expression eased slightly as he accepted the lesson.
I know they won't, he said.
I've known some of them all my life, for that matter. But still, it's hard.
He broke off with an uncomfortable little shrug, and Merlin nodded. Of course it is, he said, and it will be, for a while at least. But I think you can rely on the Baron to keep what's left of Narman's spies on the hop for the next little bit. And I doubt Prince Hector's going to be particularly pleased about what's happened to his spies, for that matter.
No, he isn't, is he? Caleb agreed with a nasty smile, and Lieutenant Falcon chuckled from behind him.
I think that's a comfortable understatement, Your Highness, the Prince's chief bodyguard observed with a certain relish.
He'd never been privy to all the details of the hostile espionage networks in and around Telesburg, but his position as Caleb's guardian meant that, despite his relatively junior rank, he'd been better informed than most, and he was delighted by what the Sajin's arrival had done to them. His only real regret was that the decision had been made to leave so much of Hector's spy rings effectively intact. It probably didn't feel that way to Jaspar Maison and Oscar Mulvane, of course. Mulvane, in particular, had gone into hiding when the warrant for his arrest was issued. He had no way of knowing Sir Rizard Seafarmer had personally instructed the Crown's chief investigators that he was not to be successfully taken under any circumstances. Not that Seafarmer had had any objection to making Mulvane's life a living hell until the Coruscantian managed to find transportation out of Telesburg. But apprehending the man and interrogating him had been no part of Wave Thunder's plans. They might have been forced to go after Maison as well if they'd done that. As it was, they could pretend to have no suspicions at all where Maison was concerned, as long as Mulvane successfully slipped away from them. In the meantime, Hector's information-gathering capability in Caris had sustained a major blow, with the elimination at one stroke, for a time at least, of all of Mulvane's contacts. And Maison was undoubtedly going to operate very cautiously for the next several months himself, at least until he once again felt certain that he wasn't under suspicion, which was going to prevent him from rebuilding quickly, too. Most of the groundwork for the plans King Harald and Merlin had hatched would be firmly in place by the time Narman and Hector were able to build back to anything approaching their previous capabilities. Personally, Falcon would have greatly preferred to take both Mulvane and Maison into custody and execute them for the snakes they were. Since he couldn't, he was just as happy he was a simple marine, responsible for protecting the heir to the throne from direct attack, and not a spymaster himself. He understood that there were perfectly valid reasons to leave a known spy in place. He simply didn't like doing it. At any rate, Caleb said after a moment, we'll have an opportunity to start explaining things to them soon enough now.
Your Highness, welcome to King's Harbor.
High Admiral Brian Lock Island, 9th Earl Lock Island, said as Caleb walked into the large chamber high in the citadel. Wave Thunder, Merlin, and Falcon were at his heels, and the spartanly furnished room was like a cool, welcoming cave after the brilliant brightness and heat of the day outside. A single, deep-walled window looked out over the harbor, and Merlin saw Catamount far below, gleaming in the sunlight like a child's toy as she lay to her moorings. There was more than a trace of family resemblance between the Earl and the Crown Prince, and Merlin watched Caleb closely but unobtrusively as the prince crossed to the admiral and extended his right hand. Lock Island clasped arms with him, and the older man's expression seemed to ease somehow. So he was worried about the kind of scars Tyrion might have left, too, Merlin thought.
It's always good to be here, just as it is to see you, Brian, Caleb said warmly. Not that Helen isn't just a bit inconveniently placed for quick visits.
That's certainly true enough,
Lock Island agreed, and grimaced humorously.
Some of us, on the other hand, find ourselves required to make the trip just a bit more often than others of us.
And others of us are just as glad we aren't part of the some of us anymore, Caleb agreed with a chuckle,
looking past his kinsmen at the other men who'd risen from the chairs around the chamber's large table at his entrance. "If you'll permit me, Sejin Merlin," the prince continued, "I'll get the introductions out of the way, and then we can sit down and get started." Most of the waiting faces showed surprise at Caleb's obvious courtesy to his bodyguard, and Merlin was pleased to see it. If these men were buying Harald's cover story, it might hold against the rest of the world far better than he'd feared it might. "Of course, Your Highness," he murmured. "In that case, let's begin with Dr. Macklin." Merlin nodded and followed the prince across to the five men at the table. He listened with half an ear, bowing, smiling, murmuring appropriate responses, as Caleb made the introductions, but he didn't really need them. He'd already met every one of them through the interface of his snarks. Dr. Roger Macklin was the dean of the Royal College of Caris. He was a bit above average in height, gray-haired, with sharp brown eyes that were more than a little myopic. He was slightly stoop-shouldered, and he walked around with what the unwary might have thought was a perpetual air of mild bemusement. Edward Hausman was Macklin's physical opposite. Short, stout, with twinkling eyes and a cheerful smile, he was barely 40 years old, less than 37 standard. He was also one of the wealthiest men in the entire kingdom of Caris, the owner of two of the kingdom's three largest foundries, and of one of Telesburg's larger shipyards, as well as a small fleet of merchant ships under his own house flag. Although he was a commoner by birth and hadn't bothered with acquiring any patents of nobility yet, everybody knew it was going to happen as soon as he found the time to get around to it. For that matter, 4 years ago he'd married the eldest daughter of an earl, and his noble father-in-law had been delighted by the match. Rayan McHale, bald as an egg and at least 65 or 70 standard years old, was a sharp-eyed man who'd partnered with Hausman in a dozen or so of the younger man's most successful ventures. McHale was a quiet man, whose apparently unassuming demeanor masked one of the sharpest business minds in Telesburg. He was almost certainly the kingdom's largest single producer of textiles, and he was definitely the Royal Navy's primary sailmaker, not to mention owning Telesburg's largest ropewalk. Sir Dustin Oliver was about midway in age between Hausman and McHale. Although he was a wealthy man by anyone else's standards, his personal worth didn't even approach that of the other two. He was physically unremarkable in many ways, but he had powerful shoulders, and his hands, although well manicured these days, carried the scars of his youthful apprenticeship as a ship's carpenter. That apprenticeship was far behind him now, and although he'd never owned, and never wanted to own, a shipyard of his own, he was always busy. He was one of Telesburg's two or three top ship designers, and also the chief naval constructor of the Royal Carisian Navy. The fifth man at the table wore the same sky-blue uniform tunic and loose black trousers as High Admiral Locke Island. But Sir Alfred Hendrick, Baron Seamount, was only a captain. And while Locke Island was long, lean, and heavily tanned, with the crow's feet and weathered complexion of a lifelong mariner, Seamount was a pudgy little fellow. He looked almost ludicrous standing beside the tall, broad-shouldered admiral, at least until one saw his eyes. Very sharp, those eyes, reflecting the brain behind them. He was also missing the first two fingers off his left hand, and there was a peculiar pattern of dark marks on his left cheek. A powder burn, Merlin knew, received from the same accidental explosion which had cost him those fingers. However unprepossessing Seamount might look, he was the closest thing to a true gunnery expert the Royal Carisian Navy, or any other navy, possessed. Caleb completed the introductions and took his place at the head of the table. The others waited until he'd been seated, then settled back into their own chairs. They didn't waste time worrying about who took precedence over whom.
Merlin noticed with satisfaction, although Seamount did wait for Lock Island to seat himself. Clearly, though, that was in deference to the High Admiral's superior naval rank, not to the precedence of this title. All of them obviously knew one another well, which might help explain their comfort level, but it was impossible to imagine grandees from, say, Harchong or Desnair accepting the social equality of any commoner. Caleb waited until everyone had settled, then looked around the table. Despite his relative youth, there was no question who was in command of this meeting, and Merlin rather suspected that there wouldn't have been even if Caleb hadn't been the heir to the throne. "There's a reason why my father commanded all of us to meet here today," the prince began. "As a matter of fact, there are several reasons. The fact that it's imperative that we prevent our enemies from discovering what we're up to, especially with you and Sir Alfred, Bryan, helps to explain why we're way out here at Helen. It's also the reason Father delegated this meeting to me. I'm still young enough that people may not expect me to be doing anything important without adult supervision." His smile was droll, and most of his listeners chuckled. Then his face sobered a bit. "More importantly, I can disappear to meet with all of you here without anyone noticing much more readily than he could. But I want it clearly understood that at this moment I am speaking for him." He paused for a heartbeat or two, letting that sink in, then waved one hand at Merlin. "I'm sure all of you have heard all sorts of fantastic tales about Sejin Merlin. Our problem is that most of those tales, despite their fantastic nature, actually fall short of the reality." One or two of his listeners stirred, as if they found that difficult to accept, and Caleb smiled thinly. "Believe me, it's true. In fact, the reason Father's gone to considerable lengths to keep anyone with good sense from believing such ridiculous stories is because they happen to be true. Only two members of the Royal Council, Bishop Michael, and a handful of our most trusted people, like Arnald here, know the truth about the Seijin and his abilities. To everyone else, he's simply my new personal guardsman and bodyguard, and one whose imposition I've rather publicly complained about on several occasions, assigned to keep me from sticking my foolish nose into any more ambushes. A trusted and valuable retainer, but only that." "There are several reasons for that, and one of the reasons for the secrecy of this meeting is to keep certain other people, shall we say, from realizing just how important to us he is. As we all know, according to the old tales, Seijin are sometimes teachers as well as warriors, and that's exactly what Seijin Merlin is. He has things to teach us which may very well give us the advantages the kingdom needs to defeat our enemies. But Father believes it's vital that people like Narmon of Emerald and Hector of Coruscant, among others, don't realize he's the one teaching us. If for no other reason, because they would spare no effort or expense to assassinate him if they did." All eyes had swung to Merlin as Caleb spoke. Merlin looked back, his face carefully expressionless, and Caleb smiled again. "The purpose of this meeting is to accomplish several things," he continued. "First, Seijin Merlin's going to begin by sketching out how what he knows and what all of you already know can fit together to accomplish our objectives. But second, and just as important, we're going to discuss ways in which the six of you can take credit for what Merlin is teaching us." Lock Island straightened in his chair, glancing around the table, then looked at Caleb.
"Excuse me, Your Highness, but did you say where to take credit for Sejin Merlin's knowledge?"
"If I may, Your Highness," Merlin asked diffidently before Caleb could reply, and the prince nodded for him to take the Earl's question. "High Admiral," Merlin said, turning to face Lock Island squarely, "much of what I know, of what I can teach you, as Prince Caleb's put it, would be of limited value without the practical experience which you and these other men possess. In many, most cases, it's going to take what you already know to make what I can show you effective.
Each of you is also an acknowledged master of your own trade, your own specialized area of knowledge, if you will. That means that when you speak, people will listen, and that will be important, because many of the things we're going to have to do will fly in the face of tradition. Change makes most people uncomfortable, even here in Karras, and your people will take more kindly to change that comes from men they know and trust than they will to change that comes from a mysterious outlander, whatever his credentials. And on top of those factors, there's the need to introduce the changes we're going to have to make on the broadest possible basis. They can't all come from one man, for a lot of reasons. One personal reason of my own is that what I can tell you comes from the teachings of many others, some of whom I knew personally, some of whom I never met myself. It isn't my work, and I'd prefer not to be known as some sort of mysterious, possibly sinister, and definitely foreign genius, just because I happen to be the person in a position to pass it on to the rest of you. On a more pragmatic basis, if a single stranger suddenly appears and becomes a fount of all knowledge, it's going to create both more resistance from those who cling to tradition and an unavoidable tension. It's always dangerous for a stranger to become too great, too powerful. It destabilizes things, creates jealousies and resentments. It can even lead to a fragmentation of authority, and Karras simply cannot afford anything like that when so many external enemies are already gathering around you. Besides, I feel quite confident that even though something I teach you may be what starts you in a given direction, where you finally arrive will, indeed, be the result of your own energy and work. And, Mikhail said with a thin smile of his own, if you'll pardon me for pointing this out, it will also help keep you alive, Sajin Merlin. Well, there is that minor consideration, Master Mikhail, Merlin acknowledged with a chuckle.
I trust, Hausman said, his tone carefully neutral, that none of this teaching of yours is going to infringe upon the prescriptions, Sajin Merlin.
You have my solemn oath that it will not, Master Hausman, Merlin replied gravely. In fact, the king intends to involve Bishop Michael and Father Pater from the beginning to make certain of that. A few tense sets of shoulders seemed to relax ever so slightly, and Merlin hid an inner chuckle. He'd come to the conclusion that Caleb's estimate of Bishop Michael was correct. There was no question about the bishop's personal piety, but he was also a Carisian patriot. And one, Merlin was coming to believe, especially after that cathedral sermon, who had few illusions about the nature of the Council of Vicars and the rest of the church's senior hierarchy. Father Pater Wilson, on the other hand, was no Carisian. In fact, he'd been born in the Temple Lands, and he was Archbishop Erech's chief intendant in Karras. Like many intendants, he was also a priest of the Order of Schuler, which made him the local representative of the Inquisition as well. The prospect of coming to the Inquisition's attention was enough to make any Safeholdian nervous, and none of the men seated around that table was unaware of how the Schulerites' wariness automatically focused on their own kingdom. Despite that, Father Pater was deeply respected in Karras generally, and in Telesburg in particular. No one could doubt the strength of his personal faith or the fervor with which he served the responsibilities of his priestly office. At the same time, no one had ever accused him of abusing his office, which, unfortunately, could not be said about a great many other inquisitors and intendants, and he was scrupulous about ensuring that the prescriptions of Zhuozheng were applied fairly. Schulerites in general had a reputation for erring on the side of conservatism, but Father Pater seemed less inclined in that direction than many of his brethren.
Sajin Merlin is correct, Caleb said. Bishop Michael has already been consulted and given his blessing to our efforts.
Father Pater hasn't yet, and Bishop Michael has advised Father that it would be wisest to avoid embroiling Father Pater in all the details of what we're doing.
He didn't go into all of the reasons for that. There was no need to. Bishop Michael also strongly supports, the Crown Prince continued, Father's belief that the degree to which Sajin Merlin is involved in all of this should be minimized, not just for the reasons we've already discussed, although Bishop Michael agrees all of them are valid, but also because the involvement of a Sajin would automatically trigger a much more thorough and time-consuming preliminary inquisition if Father Pater were forced to take formal cognizance of it. Bishop Michael would prefer to avoid that, and he believes Father Pater would as well. After all, the critical point, as the writ itself makes clear, is the substance of that which is tested, not its origin. He paused until heads nodded solemnly, and Merlin resisted the temptation to smile cynically. All of those nodding men were perfectly well aware that Bishop Michael was effectively advising Harald on how best to game the system. But that was all right with them, because gaming the system, whether it was called that or not, had been an everyday fact for the Church's life for as long as anyone could remember. As long as Mother Church formally approved a new concept or technique, its originators were covered, and at least in Father Pater's case, approval wouldn't depend on the size of the bribe offered. And every one of the men in this chamber also understood that one major unstated reason for them to take credit for the things Merlin was about to begin teaching them was to spread out the responsibility for those innovations. To avoid having so many simultaneous new ideas come at Father Pater from a single, possibly suspect source that he was driven to focus on where they came from, rather than upon their content. "There's one more initial point Father wanted me to stress," Caleb continued after a moment. "Nothing that Sajin Merlin is about to share with us can be kept indefinitely as our exclusive property. Once others have seen the advantages, it won't take them long to start trying to duplicate those same advantages for themselves. Some of what we're going to be talking about today, like what Sajin Merlin calls Arabic numerals and an abacus, are going to have to spread widely to be of any use to us. As such, their advantages are bound to be recognized, and they're bound to be adopted by others very quickly. Others will have exclusively, or at least primarily, military implications, involving ways to make the Navy and Marines more effective. The results of those changes are going to be quickly apparent to our adversaries if and when they encounter them in battle. But Father would be much happier if people like Narmon and Hector had no idea what we're doing until they encounter those changes in battle." Heads nodded again, much more emphatically, and Caleb nodded back soberly. "In that case, Sajin Merlin," he said, "why don't you go ahead and begin?"
"Is it really that simple?"
Baron Seamount asked several hours later, staring at the coarse black grains on Merlin's palm and shaking his head slowly. His expression was a curious mixture of awe and chagrin. "It's really that simple," Merlin confirmed. "Of course, producing corn powder like this has its own set of problems. It's easy to strike a spark or even set it off from simple friction heat, especially during the grinding process. But overall, it's a lot safer and more powerful, too." He and the Navy officer stood in Seamount's office in a squat stone structure besides the King's Harbor Citadel. The office was a wide, low-ceiling chamber, newer than much of the rest of the fortifications, since it sat squarely atop the fortress's main powder magazine. "Location is everything," Merlin thought dryly. "Although, now that I think about it, maybe it does make sense to put the officer in charge of the magazine's safety directly on top of it. If nothing else, it should make sure he pays attention to his duties."
"I doubt any of those problems can begin to compare to the ones we've always had," Seamount said now.
He held out his own hand, the mangled one, and Merlin turned his wrist to tip the black powder into the captain's palm. Seamount raised it to his nose and sniffed,
then stuck out his tongue and tasted the powder delicately.
"I can see why this corned powder of yours is going to be a lot safer to handle, Sigyn Merlin," he said. "But why is it going to be more powerful?"
Merlin frowned thoughtfully and stroked his mustachios while he considered how best to answer the question. As Seamount said, the safety advantages were obvious. Safeholdian gunpowder hadn't been around that long, and it was still a very crude proposition. The exact proportions of sulfur, saltpeter, and charcoal remained a matter of hot debate among the practitioners of the artillerist's art, such as it was and what there was of it. Worse, and much more dangerously, it was still meal powder, made by simply mixing the finely crushed ingredients into a powder with a consistency very close to that of flour. It worked, more or less, but the ingredients didn't stay mixed. They separated out, especially if the mixture was jostled or agitated, which, given the state of most of Safehold's roads, meant a powder cart often found itself moving in a fine fog of highly flammable, highly explosive dust. No one on Safehold had yet thought of the expedient of moistening the powder, pressing it into solid cakes, and then grinding it to a uniform consistency. The process bound the component ingredients together, preventing them from separating back out, which explained both Seamount's awe and his chagrin. The implications for the safe, efficient use of artillery and small arms were profound, yet the solution was so absurdly simple that it was difficult for him to forgive himself for not having already thought of it. Which still left the problem of how to explain the increase in propellant force. "It's more powerful for several reasons, as I understand it, Sir Alfred," Merlin said, after a moment. "First, I've adjusted the recipe just a bit. The one you were using had too much charcoal in it. But the main reason, as it was explained to me, is that basically what gunpowder does is simply to burn very, very quickly in a confined space. When the powder is made into grains this way, there's more space between each grain, which means the fire can burn even more quickly and completely. I'm sure you've seen the same sort of process when you've poked up a fire on your hearth." It was Seamount's turn to frown. He stood gazing down into his palm, gently stirring the powder grains with the index finger of his other hand, then nodded.
"Yes," he said slowly, thoughtfully. "Yes, I can see how that might be. I never considered it before, but then again, I never had corned powder to experiment with."
He frowned some more, then looked back up at Merlin.